Were any of them any cute dog?
Yeah, and that's what I'm curious about with this new one. Like,
the VGRT Gaming Podcast, episode 487, recorded on December 19th, 2017. Welcome to the 487th edition of the TD Gaming Podcast and the 320th episode of Video Game Roundtable. I am Jonah Fowle.
I am TJ Denzer.
I am Scott Dirk.
VGRT Gaming Podcast focuses on game news from around the industry. So this is the episode just before Christmas. We're not going to have a podcast next week because I need a break. We all need a break, and we're probably all going to be busy with the Christmas vacation. So instead, we're just going to talk about our games of the year and our little awards today and leave it at that. But before we do that, what have you been playing, TJ?
What have I been playing? It's been a whirlwind week. But I have been playing League of Legends again because I don't know any better. I'm actually doing it for some work I'm doing. I have a new job and I'm going to be able to reveal what that is soon, but until that time comes, I'm just working in the shadows, and those shadows include diving back into the maelstrom of hatred that is League of Legends. I still am working my way through Wolfenstein 2. I haven't beaten it yet. It's still good. There was a little bit of like a stretched moment where it felt like it lost a little bit of that oomph. But for the most part, it got to another point where it just like puts it right back there. And I'm back into it. Like, yeah,
Wolfenstein 2 just makes me want to play Far Cry 5 more. As a matter of fact, they just released a new trailer for Far Cry 5, talking about how you can, it sounds like the typical get all these bases, you know, and Far Cry thing, but it seems to be also dealing with a little bit more of a relationship mechanic, sort of like a little Mass Effect thrown in there.
Far Cry 5 makes me want to play Far Cry 2. I don't know if, did you play Far Cry 2 at all, Jenna?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I did not play the first Far Cry. I only played Far Cry 2. And I only played Far Cry 2 basically because of the map editor.
One of the most standout things about Far Cry 2 to me was the partner system, in which you could pick someone who would, like, another mercenary that each had their own, like, perks and advantages, but they'd come with you on the journey. And, the most saddest thing in the world was if your partner went down, there was a moment where you would walk up to them and they would, like, it would like go into this quick time event where like you have to make a snap decision of whether you're going to put them out of their misery or leave them to bleed out slowly. And it was just like, no, I don't want to do that. They're my bro or sis.
Were any of them any cute dog?
Yeah. And that's what I'm curious about with this new one. Like,
that's a fun cue.
I'm curious about that.
Yeah. Speaking of which,
it's interesting, and I wonder if they're taking that from Far Cry 2, because I know I've talked to a lot of people that said that was one of their favorite features, and it's been curiously absent from a lot of Far Cry games.
Well, here's the thing. It seems like the companion mode in Far Cry 5 is more of a, do you want this kind of thing? Do you want this kind of thing? Like, if you select a pilot, they're just going to, you know, do a bombing run wherever you point. The dog is used for stealth aspects, you know, to take people out quietly so that you can sneak around, that sort of thing. So it's more of a type of gameplay style you want. So if you want to be a sneaky guy, which is always fun in Far Cry 5, you know, Far Cry 5 and Batman Arkham are the games which allow you to be a predator and make people nervous. And the more you fuck with their heads, the more nervous you get. And that's what happens in Far Cry 5. It has that mechanic of, yeah, the more you do against them, the more panicky they get and the more weapons they start pulling out and that sort of stuff. So it's sort of like Saints Row, the first one as well.
Yeah. I I'm interested to see what happens with it. I'm not sure if I'm going to be a day one on Far Cry 5, but I am curious to see how it plays out.
I'm glad I wasn't day one in Assassin's Creed Origins. I'm glad I wasn't a day one on several games, actually.
That's actually in my list of games of the year.
And the thing is that I'm not glad I wasn't on my on day one for Mass Effect Andromeda, but I was day one on Injustice 2.
Yeah.
So anyway, so what have you been playing, Scott?
I've been continuing to play Quern, working my way through that game. It's a lot of tough puzzles, so there's a lot of just sitting there trying to figure out how to solve them, and it's getting interesting. I've met the spiritual person in that game where they're trying to tell me that you need to leave and you need to get this professor guy out of there who's the guy that kidnaps you and brings you there. So it's a very interesting game. I'm having a lot of fun with it. I like the narrative of it. It feels like a more streamlined Myst, or Myst is just like you just wander around and do whatever the heck you want. Here you have like a story and a goal that you're working towards, and it feels a little bit more fun that way.
As for me, I've reinstalled Mass Effect Andromeda, and one of the sad things about them abandoning it is that it didn't get the 4K upgrade and it didn't get the HDR upgrade. When you know that EA, had this game made the money they thought it was going to make, definitely would have gotten that. Go ahead.
Oh, nothing.
And I'm just, I'm replaying it because why not? I want to see if my attitude towards it has changed at all. And if anything, it makes me think that the combat is worse than it really was. And I wasn't really a big fan of the combat before.
You went back to a bad game and found out that it was worse than you thought? That's sad.
That happens often, actually.
Wow, that is sad.
Here's the thing. It's not a bad game. Is just here's the thing. If they gave it a different name and called it Science Fiction Game Number 2, instead of calling it Mass Effect Andromeda, it wouldn't have had the same baggage, and the mediocre-ness would have just remained mediocre, And it's an okay average game, but when you have the Mass Effect title in front of your name, it can't be, And so much money was thrown into it, so they can't do the DLC, and there's a lot of questions that will remain unopened that I just realized. For one thing, I almost forgot about the Quarian arc. Remember, that was a big thing. You get all the arcs that were lost, the human arc, the Turian arc, and the Asari arc. And they talk about, the Quarian arc was delayed because they had something wrong with it, and it was carrying the Drell and the Hanar and the Elcor. And God, I wish the Elcor could have made it to Andromeda, because I would love to see those guys having to deal with greetings, I am an Elcor.
The Elcor were the best. The Hanar were a close second, but the Elcor were definitely the best.
And the thing is, and one of the things about the Drell is that, remember, they were dying because they were a desert species forced to live in a water world, the Hanar's world, because their homeworld was gone.
Mm-hmm.
And they were developing these lung problems because of it. It would have been nice for them to get to Andromeda, because I'm pretty sure there would have been a desert planet somewhere there for them, I think, yeah. Eos was the was sort of a desert planet.
So, at the end of the day, you would say that Mass Effect Andromeda is like a bad onion. There are layers to the badness.
Well, I would say that buy it if you'd never heard of Mass Effect.
You went back to it, you peeled it back, and you found something new and fascinatingly bad about it.
Well, here's the thing, I enjoyed the combat in Fallout 3 and Fallout 4, and then coming back to it, I was like, oh, geez, the combat really sucks. But here's the thing about Fallout 3, is that I played it mostly on PC, using LiveAway, because it had Xbox achievements on the PC version. So I played that version, and I think playing it on PC was a lot better than playing it on console. I think had I played it on console, I wouldn't have been the biggest fan.
Hmm.
I think being on console hurt the game. Here's the other thing, is that they're coming out with a VR version of Fallout 4, which I hopefully assume will have all the DLC. So I may hold off getting the Game of the Year edition, because like I really don't like Fallout 4 all that much. And I've actually screwed up my second playthrough, so I'm stopping it, and I'm going to start over again in like a couple of months. So I'm wondering if I should wait until I get the VR gear and then play Fallout 4 VR on VR instead.
Yeah. At the very least, playing Fallout 4 in VR will feel interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, it is certainly different from like... I mean, I think what's supposed to come out first? Skyrim VR or Fallout 4 VR?
I think Fallout 4 VR is supposed to come out first. They actually have L.A. Noire VR, and they demoed that, and it was kind of weird just having Cole Phillips' hands and creepy.
I don't want to do L.A. Noire VR until there's voice recognition where I can yell at suspects like Cole.
Or you just say, good cop, bad cop. That's all you can do is say, good cop, bad cop, doubt, whatever. Anyways. I'm still playing Cooking Dash, and I think that's a testament to how good it is, since I've dumped, I would estimate, $150 on it. But that comes with an asterisk. A lot of that money, I think $60 of it, no, not 100, maybe like $120. $60 of that comes from gift cards, and they were Google Play gift cards, so there was nothing else I could use them on except for Cooking Dash. So I'm not going to buy music with it. You know, I just burn my own CDs and put them on my cell phone. No, I'll just, you know, use it for Cooking Dash. And when you now that they have these competitions, I am surprisingly high on the list. Last competition, I was sixth in the world.
And nice.
Two of the levels, I was second overall in the world.
Nice.
I was first, except someone else who probably spent more money on the game than I did got. It's not pay to win that much. And, you know, the only thing I don't like is the rewards kind of suck. I wish they would have better rewards. I wish the top 10. See, all I got was a VIP recipe that I could easily get just by waiting 3 hours, you know.
Oh, that's a shame.
I would have preferred if you got a spin on the premium wheel. Although I will say, actually, every time you complete a level, you still get a bonus that's like a really nice bonus, like spinning a wheel. So I guess they figure the accumulation of actually getting that far, you've already gotten a crap ton of rewards. They're not going to reward you that much for, you know, you've already, you know, won a lot. So it's like, yeah, you're done already. It's fine. They do have another competition that's you alone. If you get 4 stars or better on every single episode, you get to do a final season in which you can win some really nice awards. And I've done that twice already. And I'm on my third. And you have to do all 5 in a row. If you fail on one of them, you have to go right back to the beginning. And in order to play them, you have to have VIP tickets. And those are hard to get. So you have to be really careful about trying to complete it. So, yeah, Cooking Dash is a great cell game, and I would say it was the cell game of the year, except I believe the copyright date was 2015. So it doesn't count. And I only jumped in on 2017. And all these improvements they made to the game have been recent. One of the nice things about spending a lot of money is that it also has the best customer service, because at one point you can watch videos to get gold, and that was bugged. So I just complained every so often, and they sent me free gold. Because I was spending money on the game, and, you know, they depend on people like me who spend money on the game. It's been so much that, you know, the other game I played that I've actually spent money on is Animation Throwdown, and that game, you know, I still play it, but only because I log in to get the daily rewards and occasionally play it. So it's sort of like Cooking Dash has occupied my time. I will say this, I've been playing a lot of Words to Go, which is a free game, and really there's no reason for anybody to actually spend money because it sometimes runs ads, and that's it. And it's basically playing Scrabble, and I've been playing multiple Scrabble sessions with people, friends and strangers, so I highly recommend that if you want to play that, if you like Scrabble.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, I've been playing a lot of Civ 6 lately, and the reason is that the expansion news has gotten me jazzed up for it, and as Scott knows, they just revealed the Mongols, and Genghis Khan is back.
Khan!
Genghis Khan. I wonder if they're going to have Kublai Khan.
Well, Kublai was in Civ 4. I don't know if they'll do alternate leaders for the Civ. There's probably other Civs that people want alternate leaders for. Yeah. And Genghis Khan has a couple interesting abilities.
Yeah, the thing that everybody's talking about is the fact that if you attack a cavalry unit with your cavalry, there's a chance he might steal their cavalry unit.
Mm-hmm.
With the Mongols?
Yes.
Yeah.
You could actually there's a chance you might actually take the unit instead of kill it.
Yeah, it's kind of like with the Germans' ability in Civ 5, how you could steal units in that one. Here, it's only just a cavalry.
Well, it makes sense when you're talking about Genghis Khan.
You can steal. And
you also automatically
get like bonus attack, I think.
All
the horse units.
Genghis Khan is going to have a lot of espionage because when you create a trade route this time with Genghis Khan, he automatically builds a trading post in your city. Which is very interesting. So he'll be building those trading posts immediately and getting information about your civilization fairly quickly.
Yeah, and there's a replacement stable. I forgot what it's called, but it gives extra movement for any horse units built in that city. And yeah, the whole Civ is very horse themed and focused. From his units to the war, to his war ability of capturing units, and even I consider the trading post part of that as well. So it's very interesting to see what this Civ will be able to do, and I think there'll be a good competition for Scythia.
So my current game, I'm doing random leaders, and I got Macedon, which is interesting, and I'm actually pretty enjoying Alexander. We're not going to talk too much about Civ 6 because this is not the turn cast, but there's a lot of stuff coming out about Civ 6. Like, they just talked about how they're retweaking all of this of the governments. And as a matter of fact, one of them is actually useful now, and that is they're making formerly useless governments actually kind of useful now.
Nice.
Well, that's always good to hear. I don't think it's good to have useless options in a game with options. Good to have all of them be valid and strong.
Well, like democracy, it's not going to have the bonuses it had. Now it's going to give you +2 production and +1 housing per district and a 25% discount on gold purchases.
Oh, that's always good.
Yeah. I mean, when you have the Classical Republic, now you get all the cities with a district now get +1 housing. You know, it's like a lot of them are getting revamped.
So. That's good. I hope that helps. Yeah. Sounds like it will.
Yeah. Then I have the Matterhorn. They also nerfed some stuff like commercial hubs and harbors no longer grant trade routes. Now you have to build a market or a lighthouse in order for that to become active.
That's gonna suck, because I remember that's what was like one of the primary strategies is build harbors and market or commercial districts to get your trade routes, and so it'll be a little bit harder to get to those trade routes then.
There's a lot of stuff that there's constant stream of information about the someone's breathing into the mic.
Sorry.
Wasn't sweeping, it was breathing. Okay. So there's that. And I think we just petered off. All right, we're going to move straight on to news now. The first news item is Soul Calibur 6 is finally bringing the Tale of Swords and Souls to PC. And this comes to us, appropriately enough, from PC Gamer. The Soul Calibur series has been around since the late 90s, but 6 marks the first appearance on PC. It's a fairly traditional beat-em-up in most respects, but with a focus on melee weapons and the ability to move in 8 directions, rather than being stuck on a flat Street Fighter-style plane. So, as well as blocking and parrying, you can sidestep away from the beautifully animated swings of your opponent's swords, staffs, axe, or claws. The series is also famous for a wild variety of its characters. There's a katana-wielding samurai, Mitsurugi, the ghostly pirate lord Cervantes, the whip-crapping warrior Ivy, who also has massive tracts of land, shall we say, the weird contortionist group, contortionist gimp Voldo, just to name a few. And they all feel distinct thanks to the quality of the series' animation, in particular strengths and weaknesses of their weapons of choice. The final roster for 6 hasn't been confirmed yet, but Mitsurugi and the nimble sword and shield fighter Sophitia are available in the early demo. Longtime fans will be glad to know that Soul Calibur hasn't changed that much that at all. Longtime fans will be glad to know that Soul Calibur hasn't changed much at all, but there are some new additions to the traditional formula, including a system designed to give rookie players a chance against more experienced fighters. Hold the reversal edge button and you slowly charge up for an attack that, if it lands successfully, grinds time to a halt and forces both players into a violent game of rock, paper, and scissors. You have a few seconds to guess what the other player is about to do and react accordingly. Charging reversal edge, however, leaves you briefly open to attack. There's some risk involved in trying to trigger one. Soul Calibur 6, which producer Motohiro Okubo considers a celebration of the series' story 20th anniversary, is due for a release sometime next year, and it's going to be also out on Xbox One, PlayStation 4, and Nintendo Switch. The other thing that we know about Soul Calibur is they love their guest fighters. I mean, like, Soul Calibur 4 had Yoda and Darth Vader and Link. So it'll be interesting to see what the PC version gets. Because that's the other thing, is that a lot of times that the characters that are included are specific to the consoles they're included for. Like I said, the Nintendo Wii version of Soul Calibur got Link on their side.
Yep. PS2 versions of Soul Calibur 2 got Heihachi from Tekken. And then the Xbox version got Spawn. And yeah, they've had a bunch of good characters over their years. So, Ezio Auditore from Assassin's Creed was a character one year. So it's always interesting to see who they're working with on that and who they're pulling in.
All I remember is Sophitia jumping on a guy's shoulders and snapping their neck with her thighs.
Mm-hmm.
And also, it's also going to be massive, massive breasts. They keep on getting bigger with every game. It's like Power Girl. They want to see how big they can get before it becomes ridiculous.
Yeah. It's going to be super interesting, though, because they've had a strong guest character game in Tekken 7 this year. For those who don't know, Tekken 7 featured Akuma from Street Fighter, Geese Howard from Fatal Fury, and then Noctis from Final Fantasy 15, which I wonder why they didn't save Noctis for a weapon fighter like Soul Calibur. Because, I mean, he uses a sword, and he uses a sword in Tekken. It's kind of weird. But at the same time, I'm just hoping that they'll be bringing someone better. The last time we had a Soul Calibur game, it wasn't all that great. The series was starting to languish a bit. It was starting to trail off. Tekken 7 has kind of revitalized their 3D fighters, so I'm hoping they're going to take some lessons they learned from Tekken 7.
Or Street Fighter X Tekken.
Yeah, it sounds like they're taking some ideas from this rock, paper, scissors thing. To me, it sounds a little close to what Injustice 2 has going with the clashes.
You know what I'd like to do is if they actually do rock, paper, scissors, you know, 1, 2, 3, scissors beats rock. Oh, and rock beats scissors, actually.
Indeed.
Scissors beats paper.
But I mean, Bandai Namco are people that they're learning as they go. They're looking to other people. They're definitely looking to Warner Brothers with that Clash system.
Yeah. So it's funny because this reminds me that I sent you a video, the latest video for Dragon Ball FighterZ X. I was wondering if you saw it.
Is that the one with the new characters?
Yeah, and were you able to recreate scenes from the series?
Yeah, it's looking strong. That game is going to be like every teenager in the 90s and 2000s Saturday, their after school afternoon boiled into one fantastic fighter, and I'm here for it.
All I can do is boil it into one word. It's over 9,000!
I'm still waiting for him to release Raditz. I want Raditz as a character because he would be such a troll character to use.
They haven't released the character list, I believe. They only have the obvious ones, but they haven't really said what the full roster is.
they have been like teasing them in three at a time, little by little, each time.
Learning something from NetherRealms right there.
Yeah. So I'm hoping against hope that the useless Saiyan Raditz will show up.
Either way, speaking of Injustice 2, I've been playing with Adam, the Atom, and he's really fun to play. Especially when you do his special power, he just becomes a tiny little, like Tinkerbell. He's just tiny. He's a tiny spot of light, and he's just beating the crap out of them. And one of the funny things, if you manage to put someone in the corner as the, when he's in tiny, you see this little light bouncing someone up and down, up and down, up and down in rapid succession. It's just so hilarious.
Can I tell you how much I love that he doesn't actually crouch? He just grows a little smaller.
Yeah. I will say that I love the ending of his super move in which he just becomes a giant and just pounds someone into the ground with his fist. I also like the fact he's Ryan Choi rather than Ray Palmer. It's an interesting choice. And one of the funny things is that if it's possible that if you have him fight Supergirl or Power Girl, each of them will be in their civilian clothes and then getting into that outfit. So, yeah, I mean, it's looking good. I'm pretty sure Enchantress is going to be next because they don't want to release the Turtles until people are practically begging for them. They're sort of like giving people fighter game blue balls that way. And, you know, not much has been said about the Enchantress yet. I mean, she looks sort of generic, but it'll be interesting to see, A, what kind of fighting she does, and B, what her super move is.
I imagine she's going to be similar-ish to Dr. Fate. I don't know.
That's going to be interesting, actually, having a fight between Enchantress and Dr. Fate, because one of the great things about Injustice 2 is that pre-fight dialogue is a lot of the times is specified between the two characters, which is fun, you know. I certainly hope at some point they do an alternate skin, which is Ray Palmer. Although the entire point Ryan Choi is the Atom right now is because Ray Palmer is missing and he's looking for him.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a pity. Anyways, we're going to move on to the next item. Go ahead, TJ.
The Witcher 3 Xbox One X update could add support for HDR displays. From WCCF Tech. It was reported a few days ago that the Witcher 3 Xbox One X update could be really close to release, given that its status was changed from in development to coming soon on Microsoft's official list of enhanced games. The list has been updated again now, adding support for high dynamic range, HDR, displays in the nearby column. This is interesting, as CD Projekt Red didn't mention HDR when asked about it in the interview published on the Xbox Wire blog. This led many to believe that we would never witness the beautiful landscapes of The Witcher 3 and the full glory of HDR and wide color gamut. However, there is hope again with this listing update, though the official confirmation is still to come. Of course, Xbox One S owners could still enjoy the addition of HDR too, and there's no reason to believe CD Projekt Red wouldn't bring this graphics update to PS4 and PC as well.
And the only reason I find it interesting is I still have not played The Witcher 3, so I'm guessing if I wait a bit, I can get The Witcher 3 with all the DLC in the Game of the Year edition, and wait to purchase it until the graphic update is released.
Yeah, that's not a bad idea. I mean, either way, you're getting like 120 hours worth of game there.
Yeah. So like I said, now you guys have played Witcher 3, right?
I have not played it yet. I've played the first two games.
Really? Because everybody talks about how much of an improvement 3 is over 1 and 2, especially 1.
Witcher 3 is, like, it's a spectacular peacocking from Witcher 2 and Witcher 1. Witcher 2 is still pretty good. There's a lot of good things going on in that game, but Witcher 3 is just, like, it's everything that was great about Witcher 2 expanded into a super massive world with all sorts of things to do and all sorts of things to explore at any given time.
You know, I hear that The Witcher 3 is more Mass Effect than Mass Effect Andromeda was.
That wouldn't be a wrong statement. Personally, I think Witcher 3 has some of the best environments I've ever explored in an open world RPG game.
What elements of Mass Effect are you comparing it to? Because this seems, from what I've read, he's very grim and...
I don't mean the character style. I mean the gameplay in terms of the way the campaign and the side quests are set up. Because from what I understand, the side quests never feel like something extraneous that you might as well do because you're bored. Everything feels organically together. Because when you played Mass Effect 1, 2, and 3... the side quests felt very natural, you know? I mean, and by side quests, I guess I mean the loyalty missions. You know, they always felt like they were part of the story. And I think that's
right, because they're helping to build.
And that's what I hear about Witcher 3, in that the side quests never feel like a chore, and they feel integral to the main story, even if you don't need to do them.
There's something to be said for a game in which you're actually playing a mercenary that for hire that his job is actually to hunt monsters, because that helps in that whole, like, of course he would hunt monsters for gold because that's his job.
I remember the review for The Witcher 1 by Zero Punctuation, and he was talking about, wait a minute, this is a MMORPGer. This is an MMO, a single player MMO, but still an MMO, because you have to do all these little fetch quests, you know, gather three skulls and bring them back and all that stuff. And, of course, a lot of people played Witcher 1 just for the wanking material on it.
Witcher 3 was really cool in the way it set you up for monsters, because there was always, like, generally speaking, there was always some kind of setup to it where, like, you would have Geralt talking about what he would need to pull off this hunt properly and the setup that went into it. Like, it wasn't just going and fighting the monster. It was like finding ingredients to build a potion that would, you could coat your sword in to poison, to kill the monster better. And then a potion for yourself that would make you resistant to that, whatever that monster is doing.
Mm. This reminds me that Monster Hunter World is coming out in about a month.
Yeah. And I mean, if anything, I would go into Witcher 3. I would go back to Witcher 3 again, if only for Blood and Wine. That is the most. That is one of the most gorgeous DLCs and like explorable environments.
Well, you mean when you get the HDR upgrade?
Yeah, I mean, like, if they put that in there, I would totally go back to Blood and Wine.
Is Blood and Wine included in the Game of the Year edition?
It should be. That was the third DLC that came out.
Yeah, and the Game of the Year edition is going to have everything in it. Which reminds me, right now I wish I hadn't spent $25 on Madden, because there's an Xbox Live sale going on right now for Xbox Gold owners, and I could get Elite Dangerous Ultimate Edition with all the DLC in it for $30, which I could.
Wow.
And I had $5 off at the time, and now I wish I had spent it on that instead of Madden, which is off my hard drive because it sucks so badly.
Buyer's remorse.
Yeah, and I can't even turn the disc back to the to GameStop because it's a digital download. So that's the one downside of digital purchasing.
Yeah.
I'm gonna wait for the enhanced version to be patched to be released, and then I'll probably get The Witcher 3 just to see what everybody's going on about it. I'm pretty sure it's good, you know, but there's just so many RPGs and so many wide sprawling RPGs that are going on. And, you know, I hear CD Projekt Red talking about how much bigger Cyberpunk is. Makes me wonder what that's gonna be like.
Yeah. I can't wait to see what we actually get from that. I can't wait to see the day when we actually start getting like reveals and trailers of that. Like,
yeah, they still have the one trailer from E3. the teaser from E3. That's all we've seen of it.
And I really want to see a new type of, I've always been into Shadowrun and games like that, so I'm really into the idea that CD Projekt Red could pull off something like that.
I would love to see Shadowrun as a episodic TV series.
That would be interesting as well. I would love to see.
They have that that orc cop show that's coming out.
Yeah,
you might as well
make it a little cyberpunk.
Did you play the Shadowrun games that came out on the Steam?
Yeah, well, I actually backed it on Kickstarter, and the only issue I have with it is that it feels like it was made with something like the RPG Maker. It feels so professionally amateurish. Like there's an editor that someone can use to make their own Shadowrun games. It is so bare bones that I wish they could have done more with it.
Yeah, I was hoping it would be like a connected world kind of thing, and not just like, well, here's level the docks level and here's the back alley level kind of
thing.
Here's the thing,
you know, you could, if you play Pillars of Eternity, you don't think, oh, I could do something like this. But when you play Shadowrun Returns, it's like, yeah, if I had the proper editor, I could make my own story and my own game in this universe.
Yeah.
So anyways, we promise you the games of the year, and that's what we're going to give you. We're not just going to give you the straight up best games of the year, or what we consider the best game of the year and stuff like that. We got to be inventive about it. So I had everybody do like at least 20. I don't know how many TJ made, but I convinced Scott to really open up his writing abilities to find new angles to awards. And I guess I will start with the first one. And it's going to be a very basic award, and that is the best graphics artistic definitely goes to Cuphead. Because Cuphead is a visual splendor. Now, yes, it's derivative and it's an homage, but it's still an incredible feat. You know, because they had to hand draw all of that animation. And here's the interesting thing. It runs on 60 frames per second in terms of gameplay, but it's also running at 24 frames per second in terms of animation deliberately to make it seem like an actual film. I mean, they add the film grain and all that stuff, but they had to make it 24 frames per second within 60 frames per second gameplay. Just to give it that feel of watching a cartoon from the 20s and 30s.
Yeah, Cuphead was, I mean, it was marvelously fun to play through. I really enjoy not just the spaghetti arms and legs on every character, but like the music too. They really push that music to the nth degree to give it that vibe and just make it feel like a cartoon in action.
Yeah, and here's the thing. It was hard in that way Dark Souls is hard, in which you keep on hitting your head over and over and over and over again, but only because it feels so good when you stop hitting your head.
It was so much more gentle than Dark Souls. I really am not a fan of that analogy, just because with Cuphead, you die and you go back to the beginning of the level, and the levels are only really the levels and the boss fights are really only about probably 5 to 10 minutes long from beginning to end. So you're really not losing much if you die. I like that about it. I like that it.
Well, there are games like that, like Super Meat Boy and N++ are revolve around the fact that they know you're going to die quickly. So, boom, here you are, right at the beginning, no waiting, no reloading, just boom, you're at the beginning again.
Absolutely. And more than I can get into a game that's hard, like, I'll play a game that's hard. I've beaten my share of Dark Souls and all that stuff.
Well, it's not only that it's hard, but it's also feels rewarding.
And it respects your time.
But it doesn't respect you in that you think you did good, but it says, oh, C minus.
you died too much, or you took too long, or
yeah, it's basically it's a very hard grader.
That's okay. I'm a B student. I don't need A's to win the game.
Yeah, but that's just it. What's it called? You're gonna get C plus, C. Hey, at least in Bayonetta, occasionally I would get pure platinum, and I've gotten to the point in which I'll usually get gold. I don't get, oh, what's his name? I forgot his name. Falling on his ass. Oh, come on. Jeez, it's not Ezio. I want to say Ezio, but that's a different character. It's an E name, but. Which disappoints me, by the way. Bayonetta 3 was announced, and it's only going to be on the Switch again, and it's going to be like, yep. Well, it sucks, but I'm not going to play it.
Enzo. Enzo's the
Enzo.
Character.
That's why I want to say Ezio. There's an E and a Z in his name. So, Scott, give us one of your awards.
Okay, I'm going to maybe start at the bottom. The Professor Barbie doll war goes to Leighton's Mystery Journey, because apparently the main thing to do with her is to dress her up in the different costumes of the various characters that you've seen in the previous series, as opposed to, you know, solving mysteries.
Is this a case of "and your reward is clothes" sort of thing?
Yeah. Well, it's a little disappointing.
It's a Japanese game. They have all sorts. You know, remember, a lot of these games had microtransactions. $1 for this set of clothes, $1 for that set of clothes, $1 for these clothes. Clothes, clothes, clothes.
Yeah. They have a little different outfits. Yeah, it's a little disappointing to see it in that game, because like the first six games are nothing like that, and then this feels like a departure from that kind of formula. So it's a little disappointing.
Yeah. Okay, TJ, give us one.
We're going to knock this off the list right now. Honorary Owlboy indie platformer stand-in stealing my heart is Hollow Knight. I absolutely loved Team Cherry's Hollow Knight. It's been taking me for a journey. It's taken me for a loop. It feels challenging. There's a lot going on in that game as far as like the skills that you get and what you can find to equip yourself with. And the characters are just really fun for everybody being bugs, which I'm not fond of bugs, but I'll deal with these bugs. If all bugs were like these bugs, I wouldn't hate bugs.
Just, you know, watching reminds me of games.
It's a feature,
like,
not a bug.
Like Hue and all those other, you know, sort of more action-y Limbo, you know. I know it's a Castlevania game or Metroidvania game. But, you know, they love it. Huge.
Yeah. It's an extreme Metroidvania game. There's a lot of area to cover. And thank God for fast travel. I mean, you have to unlock it, but it does have some shortcuts in between that make it just that much more manageable. It really does do like all the things that I would want a platformer to do if I had a problem with it and I was going to complain about it. Hollow Knight addresses a lot of my concerns about a lot of different Metroidvania style games.
Yeah. To me, it's the best game that Behemoth never made. Because it looks like a Behemoth game.
It's so much more cleaner, I think. I get what you're saying, but and it does have I mean, there is literally a dung beetle that rolls up big balls of poop and throws them around the room at you. And he acts like a chivalrous hero. His name is the Dung Defender.
Well, in that way, it's more like a rare game, specifically Conker's Bad Day. We need a singing poo in a game. We need more singing poos.
And there is a thing that you can get from the Dung Defender. It's a badge that makes you smell like the Dung Defender. And if you talk to anyone while you're holding that badge that isn't the Dung Defender, they'll hate you.
And it's, you want that?
Just to open up that dialogue, just to have that little bit of extra something in there. It really is like something like that, where just like there's so many nooks and crannies to explore in that game that you could even if I beat it, I would probably go back to it again just because I'm sure that I've missed something.
Would you like to mention the soundtrack?
Yeah, it's got a really gorgeous soundtrack. Right from the get-go, it opens up to like a really somber and like really sort of heart-plucking soundtrack that sets the tone for the whole thing. Like it's quiet where it needs to. It does the thing that that everybody loves about Super Metroid. It's quiet where it needs to be. And it's action-packed where it needs to be, and it's emotional where it needs to be. It doesn't, like, rely on putting music where it doesn't need to go. Instead, it puts it where it needs to be, and it does it well.
Yeah. So, my turn. And this time, I'm going to remain on the subject of soundtrack. And for the best score, I, you know... You could always mention Cuphead. You could always mention Hollow Knight. But I guess I'm going to go with Nier Automata, simply because you kept on raving about it. So I listened, and I said, yeah, you know. And rather than give Cuphead two awards, I would give Nier Automata the best score award, since the rest of the game is okay.
Yeah, I can. Yeah, I mean, you've heard my my love as well as my complaints about it. I love that soundtrack. It is it's not just, I've said it before and I'll say it again, it's not just a good game soundtrack. It's a good soundtrack for putting on the background noise as background noise as I'm doing anything else.
Yeah, and you can't do that with Cuphead because that'll just jangle your nerves as this big band music keeps playing.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
How about you, Scott? What's your next award?
I nearly forgot that this was a 2017 game, so I'm going to give this the Marty McFly Travels to the Past and Brings It to Us in the Future or the Present, Thimbleweed Park. This is the game that was made to be like if you found it in a drawer and you've just forgotten about it, and so you have this new 80s game to play.
Yeah, using the Scum Engine.
It's a point-and-click game.
Hmm? Using the Scum Engine. The old LucasArts Scum Engine.
The Scum Engine, yes. And you, it's a point-and-click adventure game using the Scum Engine, and you are trying to solve this murder mystery, and eventually the game just totally breaks the fourth wall with you, and you know it tells you, you know, like you're in a game world.
By the way, we should really explain what the Scum Engine was. Scum stands for Script Creation Utility for Maniac Mansion. And Maniac Mansion was the first graphic game that actually used sort of a visual way of doing inputs rather than using a parser. Mm-hmm. So if you ever saw something like Full Throttle, it used the Scum Engine as well.
Right.
Yes. And unlike the Sierra games that used a little icon like a walk or an eye hand, this one uses pick up, talk to, move, push, pull, stuff like that.
Doesn't it
and
have taste?
You can also switch between characters.
Doesn't it have taste too, Thimbleweed Park?
It might have, yeah.
Because I remember one game having a Scum Engine with taste as an option, and you could taste anything. And it was giving you bizarre responses and stuff that you really shouldn't be tasting.
Leisure Suit Larry had that, and it was really weird.
Okay. I think it is in Thimbleweed Park because there's a line where you, if you're the female character and you get her to taste something, she was like, "You wish," or something like that. It was like, it was just funny. But yeah, so this was a really fun nostalgic trip back into, you know, point and click adventures. And well, there was even a little thing where you had to pixel hunt for a little, speck of dust. And if you collected them all, you got an achievement for it. So that was fun. And they even released an update for it somewhat recently where you could actually get into the arcade game, the arcade, place because it was locked for the longest time and now it's open and you can go in there and play the arcade games in there, so there are little side games now to play.
Nice.
Okay, your turn, DJ.
Let me pull it up here. You know what, I'm going to go with best non-sport sports game that is very sporting. Pyre.
Right.
So this came from the same folks who did Transistor and Bastion, Supergiant Games. It has a lot of narrative. There's a lot of story to this game. It's the story of like all sorts of different vagabonds and wastrels and criminals living in this horrible wasteland of a world where they were exiled for whatever crimes they committed, and their only chance at redemption is to earn their freedom through this this series of trials, which is essentially a ball is dropped into the middle of a playing field, and you have to use three characters of your own against your enemy's three characters and get the ball into their pyre. And very surprising just like how much strategy and how much speed and reflexes went into like the game itself. Because it is a, like, it's a super narrative heavy game. It's a super RPG heavy game with choices and little bits here and there, and dialogue here and there. And it's really interesting that that's the way they chose to go with it, because it's not something you see very often.
So now I'm going to skip around, and I'm pretty sure that I haven't checked his awards yet, but I'm pretty sure he might have said something about it. I'm going to go with a straight-up award. Best handheld console game I'm giving to Metroid Samus Returns. I'm pretty sure Scott has a lot to say about that game. Did you give it an award, by the way?
Yes, I did. I call it the Sight for Sore Eyes Award, to be a return to Metroid, because I haven't played it since, like, Super Metroid, or at least, you know, a side-scrolling one. And this one had, like, just wonderful music, wonderful graphics, wonderful gameplay.
We should mention it's a remake of Metroid 2.
Yes, but it still felt like a new game because I hadn't played Metroid 2 at all. And in fact, it feels like there's stuff that I know the original Game Boy would not have been able to do. So I feel like they really added stuff to it with this game. Like, you wouldn't be able to do the free aiming where you can aim 360 degrees, because it just had a little directional pad. So it would have been like 45 degrees. It wouldn't have been at a weird angle or something, which you can do on this one. So I think there's a lot of stuff that they put into it to make it different and not just a straight remake. You know, the graphics are beautiful, and they said the music's good and very challenging, and just it feels like a new Metroid game.
I mean, and it should. I mean, if you really think about it, the first Metroid 2 was on Game Boy, and it was extremely, like, the hardware was extremely limited, even in comparison mm-hmm. to NES. You didn't have colors. Yes. You had very blurry details. Mm-hmm. And like, there was so much to expand upon with that one that I just don't think you could have done with anything else at this point. Because at this point, we've even seen the first Metroid. It came out again on Game Boy Advance's Metroid. It was Zero Mission, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Which was just a re-exploring of the first Metroid. So they've walked that ground already, where they took the first one and brought it up to speed. I think it was a perfect idea to take the most limited Metroid game of all time and expand it into this amazing thing.
Yes. It's like so much so that I couldn't imagine how it was in Metroid 2. It just, there's so much. It's like, this would not have worked on that Game Boy. It couldn't be anything like it. It just feels, it has to be different, because I remember playing the old Game Boy games, and they were limited, and they didn't move and do the things that this game is doing, and it just felt like a major improvement. And again, like, I feel like I'm playing the sequel. It's the prequel sequel to Super Metroid. It's so weird to say.
I will say this: I had Metroid 2 on Game Boy. It was one of the games I had in my library when I was little. And mm-hmm. that game was super hard. That game was super hard, and it was super difficult. You had no maps. You had to remember everything yourself. And it was, you had to want to play through that. It was the kind of game I played through it because I didn't have enough money. I was a little kid, and I didn't have enough money to go and buy anything else. So, I mean, that's the game. This is the game that you got for the summer. Might as well play it every day until you figure it out.
I remember I got a Athena.
I think Metroid 1 was also like that, where you didn't have maps telling you where everything was. You had to remember where the stuff was. And this time
Or you can call that toll number.
Oh, yeah. Or have Nintendo Power.
Nintendo Power, you know, hotline. We're here to help you.
That's what they wanted you to do.
Did you see the movie, what's it called, The Wizard? Well, and by the way,
speaking of respecting you as a player, then, because, you know, you don't feel forced to doing that kind of stuff, and they give you a good map system. They give you an ability to do scanning around, so you know where power ups are. You just have to figure out how to get to it.
Well, here's the thing: at least it wasn't Castlevania 2. Simon Belmont what was it? Simon's Quest?
It was, yeah, Simon's Quest.
Yeah, that game was impossible to complete without calling somebody. It was completely impossible. And it was made to be impossible without having to call the hotline. There was no fucking way in hell that you could have known, what was it, to put the special thing in a special place that there was no hints about whatsoever in the game itself.
I knew because there was a in my school library in my elementary school.
If you're going to talk to people or read a book, sure. But you still had to get an outside source.
we had a book in my grade school library that was the best Nintendo tips and tricks.
Not tips and tricks. It's a fucking guide.
And it was like a bunch of different like tips and hints for like. I guess probably about 10 to 12 Nintendo games. I remember it had Double Dragon, the original Double Dragon in there. It had Wisdom Warriors 3, and it had Simon's Quest.
Oh, yes. Equipping the blue crystal, kneeling by the water.
No, you do it by the mountain, and then the tornado picks you up after you hold it for 7 seconds, mind you. Don't just stand there, don't just do it for like a second. You actually had to know to hold the crystal there in a crouched position for 7 seconds, and then the tornado comes.
Oh my God, who does that? Imagine if you did it by accident and you don't know how you did. It's like, wait a minute, I got past it, yay, but how did I do it? That actually happened once to me in a game. It wasn't because I didn't do console games. I remember the first time I played Grim Fandango, I solved that tree puzzle without realizing how I solved it. I learned, the second playthrough, I said, oh, that's what's going on. But the first time I did it was pure luck. But at there was least another... it let you know how you're supposed to do it, and it hinted around how to do it. Simon's Quest, there was no clue without looking into a guide.
It was like Zelda 2. It was horribly translated, and there was a tip, but it was like an extremely vague and terrible one from one of the townspeople. That's like, go to the wall and hold the jewel, then you will see where to go next.
Yeah, whatever.
Not quite as bad as I Am Error, but you know.
Yeah, it's TJ. What's your award?
Let's see. The best game I hate so much was Resident Evil 7.
Okay, well, that's also on my list. I have it as the best game you'll only play once. And I think for a different reason. The reason why I gave it that is that it has no replay value whatsoever, aside from getting DLC. There's no replay value at all.
It has a choice, Jonah. A choice. Yeah. A choice with... extremely different outcomes.
Yeah, sure.
There's the choice that doesn't kick you in the nuts, and the choice that does kick you in the nuts.
Well, here's a question, though. Now, the Zoe DLC is coming out in the Game of the Year edition, right?
I can imagine.
I mean, no. Has it been released, or is it part of the Game of the Year edition?
No, they just released the Chris Redfield DLC.
Yeah, who cares about that?
Not a hero. And they're gearing up to...
You know, that's always a mark of desperation in Resident Evil when they bring back old characters.
Everybody wants them to bring back Leon because he's the best one. Chris is boring and horrible and punches boulders, which who does that?
They need to go back to Resident Evil 4, which was completely ridiculous, idiotic in a good way, and a B-movie camp.
Yes. Yes, they do. I love Resident Evil 7 a lot. I really think that it revitalized that series. I think that if they continue moving forward in that way with it, like take what they discovered from Resident Evil 7, don't go too actiony with it, make monsters that are actually terrifying and dangerous to you that you can't just like mow down with machine guns because there are no
monsters weren't very scary. They weren't scary at all. You mean those black blob things?
No, I mean Jack.
Are you talking about terrifying. The old woman who farts bees out?
I'm talking about Jack. Jack is terrifying.
Those are monsters. See, that's the thing. In Resident Evil 7, the scariest things are not the monsters. It's the rednecks.
Rednecks can be monsters.
But I'm just saying, those are the scary part. I mean, yeah, they were bulletproof until it said, okay, he's no longer bulletproof. Now's the time to fight him. First, you have to run away, and we'll let you know when you're allowed to attack him. But even the atmosphere in the game was great. I mean, even the demo in which you were looking for a videotape to pop in the VCR, that was spooky as hell.
Mm-hmm. And then, like, one of the best parts of the game, and it's been out for a while at this point, so I'm not going to feel bad about talking about this. There's literally a videotape in the game where you play a guy and you literally go through his death. And
isn't that the demo? Isn't that in the demo? So I don't know if that's much of a spoiler.
No, no. This is actually a videotape later on in the game where you're one of the TV reporters that got kidnapped, and Lucas brings you to this Lucas, who is the kid of the two redneck older people. He's a psychotic little mastermind that brings you to this room full of puzzles.
Standard for a Resident Evil game. Look at Resident Evil 4. Although, was he actually a kid or just a very short person?
He's like a 27-year-old dude that's just like living with them.
No, I mean in Resident Evil 4, the guy in the Napoleon outfit.
Oh yeah, that was like a 600-year-old kid that had stopped aging.
Oh, okay. So he was both.
But this is just like a sort of idiot savant genius and psychopath who brings you to this room full of puzzles that you have to pretty much put together, and then it kills you in the end. And what you get from that videotape is that you learn that it, when you get put in that room, if you do exactly what that guy did, you will die. And so you need to figure out how to subvert that puzzle from what you've seen already.
Like I said, you know, creative puzzles are hard to find in games, especially adventure games. Either adventure games now don't even bother with puzzles, which annoys the heck out of me. I mean, in Grim Fandango, the reason why it was so great is all the puzzles were related to the story, you know, and they made sense. Mm-hmm. Now they just don't even bother. Now it's all just a visual novel. Choose A or choose B. Oh, and here's a QuickTime event.
Yeah. This was actually – Resident Evil 7 was actually pretty good for that. Like, they actually made the puzzles – it was a blend of, like, the original
You know, the only
mansion
thing
stuff.
About Resident Evil 7, though, I'm wondering if people like it because it's not 5 and 6.
I would say that's a big part of why they like it, because it's more like 1, 2, and 3.
I mean, that's why they liked Episode 7, because it wasn't the prequel trilogy. And, oh boy, I know Scott hasn't seen it, so I'm not going to give any spoilers, but yeah, the words dumb come to mind if you see The Last Jedi. And it's like 5 hours later, you're going to be, wait a minute, huh? Uh-oh. Wait, huh? And there's a part in which is supposed to be so glorious, it ends up really being really super silly, and you'll know the part when you see it, Scott.
Okay.
That's all I'm going to say. Anyways, we're going to move on. Now, I'm going to give a triple award. It deals with clones. And no, not the attack of the clones. Different kinds of clones. First off, the best clone, and I know TJ is going to immediately agree with me on this, the best clone, Neo, which is a clone of Dark Souls.
Yes, this was on my list as well as the just different enough from Dark Souls to not make me cry game.
And it did some things better than Dark Souls.
Yes, it made levels. It made levels that you can redo easily instead of making you have to backtrack through giant lengths of game that you have no interest in doing. Plus, it's just fucking cool to have a sickle and chain. I mean, I love the Eastern flair in that game.
Yeah, and
just
the thing
like,
is that Neo is different from Dark Souls because Dark Souls is a very Western set, even though it's made by a Japanese company. But Neo, who was it? Was it Team Ninja? Yeah, Team Ninja did it.
Yeah, same guys who did Ninja Gaiden.
Yeah, they did a lot of. Well, Team Ninja is also known for, you know, endowing all their females with, you know, bouncy breasts. They can't
Which
help it.
They restrained themselves in this one.
Well, it's kind of hard when your protagonist is male and he's fighting a bunch of creatures.
There's a lot of women in the game, but like none of them I noticed were like super sexualized as opposed to like Dead or Alive. which led into Dead or Alive Extreme Beach Volleyball, which led into just being Dead or Alive Extreme when they got rid of the volleyball and just dropped the act and just made it what everybody was looking for.
Well, here's a question for you. Does Neo have the same oppressive atmosphere that Dark Souls has?
It does. I mean,
so
Japan,
your answer
Japan
right
in
there.
The
it's kind of have a hard, a really oppressive atmosphere if you have a bunch of women with breasts that could resemble beach balls.
I mean,
you can't take it seriously.
I mean, yeah. They had that adaptation in an Asian country, I forgot which one it was, of The Ring, in which Samara was a young woman with enormous breasts, and you couldn't take her seriously as a monster because you can't be scared and jerk off at the same time.
That's a salient point.
I want to see From Software try to do a Dark Souls type game. Oh no, forget that. I want to see Platinum Games try and do a Dark Souls type game. I want to see Suda 57 or 47. Jeez, I forgot his name. I want to see
Suda 51.
What?
Suda 51.
Yeah, I want to see Suda 51 try a Dark Souls type game. Maybe with Travis Touchdown.
Oh my god.
Actually, you know, now that I think about it, it would work. It wouldn't be scary, it would be funny, but it would actually work. Because all really Dark Souls and Neo and those type of games are tactical combat games, right? So I'm pretty sure you could do something with tactical combat with Travis Touchdown.
Yeah.
And by the way, there's going to be a Travis Touchdown game next year.
Yep, they're bringing back No More Heroes.
Well, here's the thing. It's not a No More Heroes game, though. That's the subtitle. They specifically said, don't expect a No More Heroes game because it's not really a No More Heroes game. We're just using the subtitle so people recognize, oh, it's in the same universe and with the same protagonist.
So. I mean, that sounds like a Suda 51 thing to do. Just like.
Yeah. Now moving on, worst clone is The Surge, and again, Dark Souls. And this could have been such a win, having a science fiction version of Dark Souls, but it just didn't work. And it didn't help. It was really, really buggy.
I should have known. I haven't heard anything about The Surge in a long time. I should have known that it didn't come out well.
And wouldn't you like to see a science fiction version of Dark Souls in which instead of, you know, you have death bots instead of creatures, you know? And the idea was also pretty dark as well, in which you play this guy who's a paraplegic, and you literally have the parts of your artificial limbs being drilled into you. And apparently they didn't know what anesthesia is. Or at least it's going so deep, the anesthesia can't help you. I mean, I like that idea. It's nice and dark and gritty, but the gameplay sucked. Which is a shame, because it's a great concept.
Yeah, I mean, that is a hard type of gameplay to pull off. I think, I mean, Team Ninja was doing Ninja Gaiden well before this, so they're perfectly equipped to build a hard melee game. I mean, Ninja Gaiden Black is one of the hardest action hack and slashes out there.
I'm going to tell you, there's a lot of people who told me that Ninja Gaiden was the only reason why they bought an Xbox console.
I can see that. I mean, it was beautiful. It was a gorgeous game. But it was also hard as holy shit. Well before anyone had ever uttered the words Dark Souls.
Well, there was also Demon's Souls.
Yeah, I remember
Souls.
Hearing about how hard Ninja Gaiden was.
Yeah. Anyway,
but they've always had that technical finesse for those types of games, so it really doesn't surprise me that they were able to pull it off the way they did with Nioh.
Right. And finally, too accurate clone, and that would be Yooka-Laylee. And, of course, it's Banjo-Kazooie we were talking about. And here's the thing. All the good things about Banjo-Kazooie and all the bad things about Banjo-Kazooie are all in Yooka-Laylee. You can't really complain about Yooka-Laylee because they gave you exactly what you wanted. The thing is that we have something called a nostalgia filter, in which we only remember the good things about a game. And I tell you what, you play the original Perfect Dark, not the remastered version, but the actual Perfect Dark, you're going to think it's a shit game because it looks bad and it plays bad. Same thing with GoldenEye. People have such warm memories about GoldenEye, but they didn't realize that at that time they didn't really expect much out of a Nintendo system. So yeah, Yooka-Laylee is everything great and everything bad about Banjo-Kazooie.
Yeah. the I have to play this and I hate everything about it game of my year. I had to write a guide on ukulele.
You had to write a guide. I pity you.
It was the most painful thing I've had to do in 2017.
You couldn't even lie about it because you were getting paid.
Yeah.
I mean, here's the thing. The graphics were wonderful, though. And, you know, I would really like to see a 4K HDR upgrade of ukulele. That I would love to see.
Yeah, they would have to take a lot of things out of that game for me to go back to it again.
I already own it, so I just want to see it. By the way, one of the games, which I never mentioned, which would probably be one of the sleeper hits. Oh, damn, I forgot the name of it. But the one in the strange platformer in which you play a snake.
Oh, yeah, the snake game. I remember that one.
Snake Pass.
That looked interesting.
Yeah, that I'll give the innovation concept. I mean, who would have thought that you could make a 3D platformer out of controlling something with no legs and no arms, and all your platforming is... You have to somehow use physics to swing your snake onto platforms so that they can wrap around it, you know? And it's one of those games. That's a very creative idea.
That is such a double entendre.
What? But it had
a... You got to figure out how to swing your snake so you can traverse the level.
I'm not talking about real life. I'm talking about a game. But, yeah, I mean, I played it at E3. It was fun. I never purchased it, and it disappeared from my brain, but I just now remembered it, because you'll never play another platformer like it.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, okay, it's your turn, Scott.
Okay, I got a couple ones.
Just give one.
Skyrim. I got Skyrim, with robot dinosaurs. I'm giving that one to Horizon New Dawn.
Yeah,
because it just looks like such a crazy concept to look like you're in this. You look like you have medieval weapon level stuff, but you're fighting these robots. It looks crazy, insane.
I gave it the best attempt to be Middle Earth Shadow of Mordor award.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what it really wants to be.
Man, I liked that game. I liked it a lot.
Yeah, but also the title made absolutely no sense whatsoever. They came out with a Computron of the coolest sounding title, sort of like Secret Wars, you know, the Marvel miniseries or the Marvel actually crossover event. That title made no sense either. At least for what was going on, I know a lot of Marvel fans are going to attack me for that one because it's beloved. It's their holy grail. It's their Crisis on Infinite Earths.
I really did like Horizon Zero Dawn, and like not just because it had a strong female character and a world that has very few of those, but because
characters. I have an award for one of those stories, and we're going to get to it once it's my turn again. Just a little teaser.
But like, there was a lot of cool stuff going on in that game, as far as like the hunting aspects, the gathering aspects, the interaction. It was interesting in a way. I mean, I guess if I was gonna look for a game that was like Witcher but like not, I don't know how to put that any other way than I love Horizon for that exact reason. Even up to the point where they put such a one of the best things they put in that game and the game and what they should put in every game like that is a photo mode, a comprehensive photo mode where you can actually like free the camera, put some filters on, mess with things visually, and just create your perfect screenshot. Okay. I love that feature.
Well, here's a question. Did you actually give the game an award on your list?
I did not.
Okay, well, now you can give it an award. The needs this feature award.
Every game in the modern era needs this feature award? Yes. Every game should have a camera feature, regardless of what the game is. If it has something worth looking at, it should have a camera feature.
Well, fortunately, the Xbox One allows you to do that on almost every game. At least do a screen cap.
Most systems do, but we're talking about a thing where you can pause the game in the middle of some action and then free the camera and manipulate the image however you wish.
I know all racing games allow you to do that now.
Yeah, and that's awesome. That's awesome. That's an awesome thing for racing games, because who doesn't want to do that?
But the thing is that racing games, you know, the thing about racing games, though, is that they, there's not much to them in terms of what you're going to look at. There's the track, there's the cars.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not like Gary's Mod, in which you can take characters, move them around, set up this, set up that, you know.
Yeah, I can see where you're going with that. But at the same time, I mean, like Wolfenstein. I think it would be really fun to be able to break outside of BJ with a photo function.
Him killing a Nazi by shoving his head in the toilet.
Hell yeah.
That should be a required screenshot for all computers. So give us an award there, TJ.
Speaking of Wolfenstein, we're going to do that one gets the Scary Mirror of the Year award.
Okay.
Because it is alarmingly on point with what the content it goes through, as far as just like what it, where we are now, how we got here, where we came from as a people.
Yeah. You know, it also got an award for me as well. I gave it the Lara Croft Award for taking damage, because BJ is a robot. He has to be. For all the damage he takes in that game, and I'm not talking about gameplay damage, you know, where people shoot you. No. I mean cutscenes. He has shit done to him, even worse than the previous game, and still he's able to walk afterwards.
I like the fact that the story actually makes it feel that way, because he does get to the point where he's just fucking broken down. And there is a twist in the game, but I think it was one of the most salient games this year, just like as far as having a finger on the pulse of what needs to happen. Well, maybe not what needs to happen, but like the problems we have, how we look at them, and what's going on around us. And on that fact, the game that missed the point this year was Call of Duty World War II.
It was one of my most forgettable sequels this year.
Call of Duty World War II completely missed the point when it went for its story mode. I know everybody goes to fucking Call of Duty for multiplayer, but at the same time, like they tried to beef up this whole Saving Private Ryan idea, but in the course of events, they took out everything that was cool about Call of Duty's story modes in the past, where you had these different perspectives. You had
remind you that Infinity Ward is no longer making Call of Duty games.
Oh, I know. This was Sledgehammer Games.
That's the problem. Because that was Infinity Ward's thing. Infinity Ward, remember, was the one who did that in ending to Call of Duty 4 Modern Warfare. And how many... Spoiler alert for a game that's 10 years old. How many games have you end up being a dying soldier near a nuclear blast?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think Call of Duty World War II doesn't take those risks. Not only does it keep you in the role of, like... It keeps you in a squad of, like, all white dudes that never die unless it's for a glorious cause. And I think that's kind of stupid and narrow as far as... Who knew that Wolfenstein, a game about just over-the-top murder of Nazis in the worst ways imaginable...
Where the Nazis won World War II, by the way.
Would have more realistic and more...
Involving?
Relatable vibes than a game that was actually based on World War II.
Okay, so my award is going to be Best Story, and I split it between Hellblade, Senua's Sacrifice, and What Remains of Edith Finch. Hellblade, because it was the best depiction, visceral depiction of insanity. You know, not the Joker's sanity, but slowly losing your mind, as Senua does from PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And What Remains of Edith Finch would normally be yet another Dear Esther, except for the fact that it does all these scenarios, and the way it does it is very interesting. the scenarios start out with a really fantastic and weird and science, you know, not science, you know, but fantasy. And each successive story makes it less fantasy, less fantasy, less, until the very final story is completely realistic. It's sort of like Inception, and it's working its way backwards through the story. I don't know if either of you played it, but, you know, that's all I'm going to give without giving away spoilers. It's also on sale right now, too.
I had What Remains of Edith Finch down as the best games or art game.
Okay. So, yeah, why don't you take it from there, then?
We're talking about, like, it starts out as a walking simulator, and I know that turns a lot of people off because, I mean, that is a good portion of what it is for a good chunk of the game. But it messes with expectations of a gamer, like, going into that, just like the way that you control things, the way that you move through the environments. It really does take, like, each world that you explore, which this is a game where you constantly unravel new worlds.
Well, and let's talk about the first scenario, for starters, which is the most batshit crazy, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Well, so, like, there is the story behind Edith Finch is that you're this descendant of the Finch family coming back to your home, which is a giant mansion full of quirky things. And whenever anyone would die, their room would be locked, and Edith goes in there and starts exploring the rooms of her relatives and ancestors. In the course of events, she finds their diaries, and one of them is this little girl who was very hungry because she was sent to bed without dinner. And so she found something to eat, and she becomes these creatures that she keeps eating. I think she starts out as a cat. And jumps onto some trees outside. Then she becomes a bird and sails through the air and kills a rabbit and eats that. And then she becomes like a snake. It goes through this wild and wacky sort of transformation sequence with different controls at each point of this and different little bits of gameplay at each part of the narrative that really just like is this girl's wild and interesting imagination.
And what's great is that it has a method to its madness. Like I said, it goes from the fantastical, and you don't know where it's going either until the last two, and then you realize, oh, wait a minute, I get it. You know, and it's sort of that feel, oh, I get it. And it becomes so grounded at the end, you say, oh, okay, I got it.
Yeah.
I'll have to check that game out. Sounds interesting.
Now, Hellblade is more of a traditional action game, but like I said, it likes to fuck with your head because there's a lot of things wrong with Senua, and it has a lot to do with loss, post-traumatic stress disorder, you know, and you're dealing with a time in which people weren't neurotic or psychotic. They were plagued with demons, or at least that's how other people treated them. Mm-hmm. So, it has one of the best female protagonists, even though she's batshit crazy. But the reason why she's one of the best is that she's one of the most real. You know, there's at some point, you know, when you're playing as Lara Croft in the reboots, it's like, oh, come on. She should be dead five times over. This isn't being tough. This is being a robot. Here, you really feel like vulnerable, even though you're a badass warrior. But the reason why you're a badass warrior is that people keep you, you know, have basically exiled you and you have no other choice. You know, so mm-hmm. There's that. Anyway, Scott, it's your turn.
Okay. I want to give the Best New Art Nouveau Game Award to Gorogoa. It's this game, it's a puzzle game where you're traveling through paintings and you have to arrange the paintings to create a path to get to your goal that you're trying to get to. And it's just really beautifully done because they seamlessly put together these different paintings. Like they'll be a painting of a bird, and you're trying to get the bird to get to this stick, and then you bring over this tree and this branch, and then the bird walks over the branch to the tree, and it's just beautiful and really good music too. And apparently it's a short game, but it's a really beautifully detailed puzzle game with paintings.
Yeah, I played Gorogoa at PAX South last year, at the beginning of this year, And I remember thinking as I played through that, it was really gorgeous and really interesting how, the way that you manipulate these pictures and move them around and fiddle with things inside each frame to mm-hmm. move the story along.
Okay. DJ, your turn.
Alrighty. You know, I'm going to go with this one. Biggest I'll play it when it's ready early access game is PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds.
You know, I thought you were going to say Fortnite, but no, you actually jumped into that early.
I did. I like Fortnite. Or Fortnite actually feels like a complete game in comparison to PUBG.
Well, here's the thing. Let's talk about PUBG now. There is a sort of controversy about the Xbox One version. Apparently it's not graphically, but it's having problems. But really, you know, PUBG is all about setup, you know, and that's where you have a keyboard and mouse, right? You can do a lot of crafting and stuff like that. In the Xbox One version, you have to do acrobatics with the controller to do stuff. So I think that it has a high learning curve when it comes to just doing the controller.
Yeah, it's not very intuitive right now. And I mean, that's the problem of early access games. I'm actually curious as to...
Which is funny, because the thing of it is an early access game, when it's had, what, 20 million players on the Steam version? Or some ridiculous number like that?
It's one of the first games on Steam to ever dethrone Dota 2 and Counter-Strike at any given time.
Yeah. We should have these. I have stupid controversies, but that reminds me of another stupid controversy with Fortnite and PUBG with the Battle Royale thing. Like, PUBG owns that idea. And no, you took it from a movie too, a certain movie called Battle Royale. So stop bitching when another game does it, because it's not exactly a unique concept.
Right. And, I mean, whatever. I mean, they're... I think it looks interesting, and I like the idea behind it, but man, it seems like there's a lot of fucking work to go through to like that game. And maybe it's that I just don't have the crew that wants to play it yet, but I'll wait until that game is full on out before I'll actually jump into it.
You know, there's a game whose developers must feel a little bad. And that's the Darwin Project, which has the same concept, sort of, kind of, which you have the crafting, you have the shrinking arena, but it's smaller. I think there's only you start out with four teams with two players on each team, and you have to cooperate. But if two people on the same team are the last two people, well, guess what? You're no longer on a team. You're going to have to kill each other now. And I hope the Darwin Project finds its audience, because it deserves one.
Yeah. It looks good. Every time I've seen anyone play it, it looks like it's well worth people's time.
Yeah. So, my turn, and we're going to do the stupid controversies of 2017. I have three of them. First one, the pettiest publisher award goes to Persona 5. And I think you know why. Atlas threatening people who dared stream their game, because they might spoil plot elements. Like, if you're watching a stream, I think people don't care about spoilers, because guess what? they already know that there's going to be stuff spoiled for it. I think we talked about it. Like,
you couldn't even take screenshots. That was the stupidest thing of all. You couldn't even take screenshots of the game, which it would remind you of every time you got an achievement, because PlayStation 4 takes a screenshot when you get the achievement. So what you would get instead was a big fat thing every time you got an achievement of, the scene could not be captured because it's blocked from coverage. And it's like, thanks for reminding me of that for fucking 50
achievements, Atlas. I remember you going on a rant when we did that news item earlier this year. You went on a rant.
That's upsetting. I mean, it is stupid. So that's the fun part about that. The achievement that the PlayStation takes a picture of your achievement so you can see when you got it. Because sometimes you might not even remember how you did it or whatever. Or maybe it's a cool achievement where you're doing a trick or something and you'd like to see a picture of it and they block it. It's like, what's the point?
Otherwise, I was just going to give it the Depressed High Schoolers Award of 2017.
I mean, it got my award for the JRPGs Are Back in Style Award. Yeah. Because literally it put... It was a JRPG.
Let's talk about Persona 5 now. Go ahead, TJ.
I mean, the Persona series has always been about kids dealing with their own personal demons in hell, and those things manifesting in a physical way in the form of these personas that become their sort of guardians that they use to fight other people and their demons. That's always been the theme of that series, and Persona 5 was like, I mean, it took JRPGs and put them back on everyone's radar, because there have been good JRPGs. I'm not going to say they aren't, because Scott has played a ton of them this year, but there hasn't really been a JRPG that made people think about JRPGs on such a scale as Persona 5.
Well, the other thing is that Persona 5 wasn't afraid to quote unquote go there. I mean, it could be brutal.
Yes.
I have to agree, because I feel like I'm the only one playing Trails in the Sky at all.
Yeah, I mean, the games are out there, but like, Persona 5 did for JRPGs in 2017 what Final Fantasy VII did for JRPGs when it was released. And people will probably take umbrage with the idea that Persona 5 is on Final Fantasy VII's tier, but you know what? It is. Come at me. I don't care.
Anyways, continuing on, the stupidest controversy award. And this one was so dumb, I could not believe it was a thing. And that is Cuphead being too hard for reviewers. I remember one reviewer said that while he loved Cuphead, you know, it was kind of hard and he wasn't able to complete it. And people jumped down and said, well, you can't review it because you're not a good game player. How can you play a game? How can you review a game that you can't even finish and it's too hard for you? You're not a reviewer. And that to me was quite possibly
that is stupid.
The stupidest thing I've ever heard in my life. Because it wasn't like he didn't like the game because it was too hard. It wasn't that he was giving it a low grade. It was too hard. No. He loved the game, but said it was hard. And guess what? That's part of why to love it. And also that he formed enough of an opinion. You know, you don't have to play the entire game to know to give a game a score. Some games you do because they have stories and you want to be able to see the entire story. But other games are just arcade games, and this is an arcade game. And you know what? You know, I didn't have to complete. How far would you have to go in Stargate to be able to review it? You know, what else? And here's the thing, Cuphead, the graphics, the music, the gameplay, that's all you need to know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's one of those games where you don't have to go very far into it to get a sense of what that game is. And I think that's a point of a good game, is where you don't have to go very far in to get what sense of the game is. You don't want to play a game that says, well, it'll get good in 30 minutes. No.
Oh, no, wait. I'll give you one better.
An hour now.
Remember when people were saying, well, Final Fantasy 13 is kind of boring, but once you get 30 hours in, it'll pick up. I'm not going to waste my time 30 hours playing a game. Oh, now it's sort of good? No. But like I said, it set off a debate of what a reviewer should be able to do. And here's the thing. Reviewers don't have to be, you know, the best at games. That's not... No. They have to be able to... The thing about being a reviewer is having a library of games in your head to know what games should be and they shouldn't be and how good they can be. And how good they can be is based on your previous experience with other games. You know a good game because you've played shitty games.
Yeah. And quite frankly, I mean, there is a vocal part of the community that thinks that, but there's also some assholes in game journalism that believe that, and not to give them air because I fucking hate them, but Ian Miles Chong is one of them. I know that that's where the Cuphead one started. Was there was a famous YouTuber that made a video and he had some trouble with the tutorial, and it began out of Ian Miles Chong just like spit roasting this guy for not being able to get through the tutorial in a satisfactory way. And I get that the people like that probably had some purpose in the game journalism world at some point, but at this point, Miles Chong is a fucking waste of space and nobody should listen to him because he's fucking garbage.
Now, here's the thing. You could have differences of opinion. I know that Tom Chick actually gave Deus Ex a really bad review. Hated it. Like, 1 out of 5 stars sort of thing. And I could see where he was coming from. I didn't agree with him, and most people didn't agree with him. As a matter of fact, I got shit for giving the first Max Payne a really bad score. 1.5 out of 5.
If you can bag it up with words, then you have every right to it.
And here's the thing. I can give some reasons why. One, it was it was based around a single gimmick. A really neat gimmick, bullet time. But the combat was shit. The levels were shit. After the subway station, everything was a dilapidated apartment building. All of the levels. All of them. Even when you have to go down into the secret lab, and it was inside a dilapidated apartment building. And on and on and on. And the writing was really bad. And I don't think it was intentionally bad. I think it was just bad. It didn't help that the lead developer scanned his face and used him for the face of Max Payne. And he constantly looked like he was taking a shit.
Yeah, he looked like he was letting out an angry fart. a spicy fart.
And finally, the most irrelevant controversy award, and that would be the Middle-Earth Shadow of War controversy over loot boxes, in which they were completely and utterly optional, and oh, by the way, you could earn them in-game anyway. So, and Jim Sterling made this his number one controversy, kept on hounding about it over and over and over again, without having actually played the game. And this is why Jim Sterling is not with a site right now, because he lacks the ability to self-edit. Remember, we were talking about Hellblade before. Remember, he gave it a 1 out of 10 because he encountered a game-breaking bug.
Right.
Could have easily seen in the forums how it happened, why it happened, and other people were suffering it too. And here's the other thing. He did not go to the developers, who, by the way, were, I believe, Team Ninja. Or was it Ninja Team? I forgot. Ninja Theory.
It was Ninja Theory was
the name of the developer. I had a game-breaking bug with Batman Telltale. And I did not go immediately and say, 1 out of 5 stars, man, this game sucks. No. You know what I did? I contacted Telltale Games and told them the problem I was having. And worked with me on it. And I finally realized it may have been either they patched it or I used the regular controller instead of the Elite controller and I got by it. I did not go on a furious rant on the YouTube or anything like that. You know? Jim has parted, quote unquote, amicably with Destructoid and Escapist Magazine. And thank goodness he has a Patreon. So he's able to, but he has to learn self-editing. Oh, and by the way, that would be the worst controversy award, would be the Patreon thing, which thankfully, I don't know if we discussed it, but, Patreon decided, oh, this is not a good idea, and backed off their plan. The unfortunate thing is I think it may have still hurt them, because here's the thing, when people leave, they don't always come back.
It didn't hurt Patreon. It hurt everyone who subscribes. It hurts the people that actually run Patreons. Because the fact of the matter is, Patreon's still making that money. They don't give a shit. Who really suffers in that are the people whose subscribers dropped their pledges. Oh, and maybe
subscribers, really. It was the patrons themselves, because they were losing people. And like I said, when you lose people, even if the problem is fixed fast, I think it was like 48 hours, they don't always come back.
Yeah, I've seen my friends post long lists of pledges that got dropped, and maybe 30% of those are going to come back. Because the fact of the matter is, people can't be bothered to do something once you get them to do it the first time.
So yeah, that was our worst controversy award, aside from net neutrality, which is another subject which we will deal with another time, and I don't want to talk about it because it's too depressing. There's a lot of depressing things going on today we're not going to talk about. we're doing this podcast to get away from depressing things. So, Scott, it's your turn.
Okay. This is the I Can Do Anything You Can Do Better Award, the Uncharted Lost Legacy.
Okay. So, here's the thing. Most forgettable sequel number two was Call of Duty World War II. My first most forgettable sequel was Uncharted Lost Legacy. And only because that it did not get the buzz that the other Uncharted games did. I mean, the other Uncharted games, you know, were whistles and, you know, like, it's like a Halo game coming out, right? You know, the publisher's going nuts. Hey, guess what? There's a new Uncharted. Here, it was like, oh, by the way, a new Uncharted game came out. Really? It was like...
I never care about people's buzz. I care about, did I enjoy the game? Was this a good game? And I think it was. And some people were talking about it.
I will say the story in Lost Legacy was far better than the first three games to me because you didn't have Nathan Drake's dickiness in it. I can't stand Nathan Drake as a protagonist. The protagonists of Lost Legacy were a lot more interesting.
They went into their backgrounds and
you had female protagonists. Let's start off with that.
Yeah, you had two, one was Chloe, and she was going on about her father's search for this lost city in this Tusk of Ganesh, and she brings along Nadine, who also lost her army, and apparently this was inherited from her father as well. This was her father's mercenary group, and so she lost that. So they're both trying to reclaim Lost Legacy, which is the title of the game. So,
gee, I wonder how they got that name.
So, yeah, so there you go.
Yeah.
It's a nice hero's journey, I think, and it's a good story, good music, and a lot of action. This is another game that likes to do the hard mode because I put it on easy, and it still threw really tough battles at me, even though I put it on easy. So I don't even want to imagine its nightmare mode. That's like that must be crazy.
You know, that reminds me of Catherine. I played on easy mode, and after a few of those puzzles, they got really hard. And I heard that in Japan, yeah, Catherine was uber hard. It was like extremely hardcore. All for a couple of characters that were repulsive to me. I did not like Catherine, or, oh god, I forgot his stupid name. Victor, was it? I don't remember.
Vincent.
Vincent, right. I couldn't care about Vincent, Catherine, or Catherine. They could all fall. They could all die in a deep hole someplace.
You hurt me because that game is one of the first games that my wife and I finished together.
Oh, it's fine if you enjoy playing it together, but you have to admit those characters were not very appealing.
They were so very petty, and I loved it about them.
So you're going for the bile fascination now. So, I'm going to give an award before you do, because I'm pretty sure you have this. If you don't have this game on your awards list, you probably do. But I'm going to go with the best remastered game that made you remember why there aren't any new games in the series, and that would be Crash Bandicoot Insane Trilogy. Because, yeah, it was a great remaster, but I'm pretty sure you knew this when playing it, DJ. You realized, yeah, this is why you don't have any more Crash Bandicoot games anymore.
On the contrary, it made me want another Crash Bandicoot game. Specifically, it made me want Crash Team Racing to come back, because I would love to see them do another kart racer with Crash Bandicoot.
That's like Mario Kart Racing. That has nothing to do with Super Mario Brothers.
Yeah, but it made me remember how much I loved Crash Team Racing.
Yeah, but we're not talking about Crash Team Racing. We're talking about the platformer here.
It all runs together for me. And I pulled out my hair and broke a controller beating Crash Bandicoot Insane Trilogy. There were some very specific points in the parts in the first game that were absurd. That said, the second and third game were notably easier, to the point where they felt more fun, they made me less angry, and I had a better time with them.
Or is it because you just got better after playing the first game that the second and third game seemed like a cakewalk because you just got programmed to you know, on what you're supposed to be doing?
There's a couple levels in the first game that they changed the physics just so slightly
to make them
that
impossible.
You have to, that they are bullshit. And and there's one level like that in the second game, and I can't remember there being much like that in the third game, although I don't know. Maybe I'm just looking at it with rose-colored glasses, but I generally enjoyed the experience of it. I thought it was fun. I thought it was interesting to bring that back and let people that didn't grow up in the original PlayStation generation, because we actually have new generations at this point. That's so weird.
Okay, the next award I'm going to give, and I don't know if you have, I'm pretty sure you've played this, but the Short Attention Span Award goes to For Honor. The game that was on everybody's radar, and it got really, really popular, and then just people just stopped playing like a month later.
What a great concept. Anyways.
For Honor, for those of you who don't know, was a three-way combat in which it was a tactical combat game, except you had samurais, you had Vikings, and you had knights, and they were all fighting each other. And one of the problems is no one ever did the one-on-one fights, by the way. They all did the multiplayer, you know, area control fights. Which I thought sort of defeated the purpose. I mean, why not do the one-on-one? Because that's the entire point. You're, you know, it's a tactical combat game. You know, there's less tactical combat when you have a bunch of you in one level.
It turns out that tactical combat is way less tactical when you can kick someone into a pit with 100% more ease. I mean,
that was the main strategy of people, and just guide them towards the pit. And oh, by the way, push.
By the way, the pit can be an actual pit, or it can be a 5-foot deep fountain.
Well, you know, the thing, if you're in a lot of armor, you might as well be dead.
Some of those guys aren't in a lot of armor. Some of those guys are barbarians that are wrestling in loincloths.
Well, and you're telling me that these guys come back out again.
But like, you know, they fall 5 feet. It's like, oh, geez, you know how the, you know, concussions and all that. Yeah, sure. Why not? let's just go ahead and make out of bounds. It doesn't matter if it's 15 feet or 2 feet of water. If you fall off, you die. That's all.
Okay.
The floor is lava.
Did you used to play that game as a kid?
Of course.
Everybody did.
Okay, how about you, Scott?
Well, I feel like we should not forget to mention, for me, I'm going to say best comeback, Zelda Breath of the Wild. This game needs to be mentioned. Because
it won the Best Attempt to be Skyrim award from me.
Yes.
I gave it best game I'll never finish of 2017.
That could be good or bad, by the way.
And I have to get a Switch and play this game because this just, it's beautiful and it looks like just a fun game to wander and explore in, and it just brought back the feel of Zelda, and it definitely had to be mentioned.
I hate to be Captain Braindown, but to me, it was just an average game, which just preyed on nostalgia and looked good, you know? But here's the thing. I guess if it doesn't really matter if the nostalgia is that good for you and you're returning back to characters that you like and you're doing stuff you never did in that type of game.
See, and that's the thing, is that I don't think it capitalized on nostalgia as much as you might think. I think it...
No, I don't think so.
The reason why I like Breath of the Wild more than I like things like Ocarina of Time or Twilight Princess is that it's so much not like a Zelda game that I really like...
Every other game, though. I mean, it's not like Hyrule Warriors in which you take Dynasty Warriors and put a Zelda skin on it. But
they really did take some of the best elements of open world exploration and bring them together in one place.
I think what people like about it, though, is that it doesn't hold your fucking hand. Every Zelda game since Twilight Princess. Oh, by the way, do you remember you have to press A to swing your sword? Yes, you told me that 5 or 6 times already in this one level.
Yeah.
There's no, hey, listen. You know, there's no nabbing.
You literally start Breath of the Wild by finding a sword in a rock that you're like, yeah, this is going to be the one. And then it breaks 2 swings later and you're like, well, shit. that's one of the reasons I'll never finish Breath of the Wild, is because whenever I jump in there, I have this idea that I'm going to go and do some of the story, and then I get distracted by all the things it has going on, and I just accomplish nothing. But I did have fun doing it.
That is Skyrim.
And like I said, you know, it's going to be interesting to see how Skyrim is enjoyed by Switch players who have never played an Elder Scrolls game.
Yeah.
I mean, who hasn't played Skyrim? I mean, if you own any other console or you do a lot of PC gaming, you have played Skyrim. So Skyrim on the Switch is going to be interesting to see what the players who don't know what all the fuss is about is going to think of that game. And they better have the space. Oh, you know what? That's going to be my biggest hardware defect that's trying to pass off as a feature, and that is going to be the memory space on the Switch. That is just plain ridiculous. There are games in which you're going to have to buy a SD card just to save on them. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, I think L.A. Noire is like 20 gigabytes right now. And you can only store, like, I think you can only store in the 10 digits of gigabytes on the actual Switch itself.
And, you know, I know that Nintendo wants to keep costs down, and I know, you know, that they don't want their console to seem too much like a computer. But, you know, a fucking hard drive would be nice. Or at least the ability, you know, here's the thing. When people have on the Xbox One, the original Xbox One, only, quote unquote, only had 500 megabytes, 500 gigabytes on it, right? Which was used up pretty fast. At least that and the PS3 and the PS4 allowed you to add a USB hard drive for space. They should have allowed you to have a USB hard drive on the Switch. But we all know that A, it has to be portable, and B, you know, Nintendo thinks all gamers are thieves and liars, and are going to do nasty things with the console that they own.
The other thing is that, like, you know, the hardware, the hard drive issue wouldn't be such a bad thing for the Switch if SD cards were as convenient and cheap as memory cards on the PS1 were. Like, I mean, I used to have like a set of memory cards for all the games I used to play on the PS1, but that was a time when those were easy to get and easy to come by. Meanwhile, an SD card costs about probably $40 for like your standard.
See, the thing is, you can see cheap SD cards now, but here at least they don't have to be micro SD cards.
Yeah.
But it is such a pain in the ass. You better select the games that you really want to play on the Switch. It's going to be like playing an old NES. You know, you only get one game per year, kiddo. Better pick that game carefully.
That said, Nintendo wins my award for most redeemed company. I mean, we're talking about them, and the fact of the matter is Nintendo made the comeback.
And oh, by the way, let's not forget Microsoft. They made an incredible Remember, people were talking shit about the concept of the Xbox One X. Oh, it's too expensive. Oh, it's gonna be, no one's gonna buy one. But you know what? They sold the shit out of out of it. And now everybody's talking about, you know, we want to save up money to get an Xbox One X because we want to see that enhanced graphics. The only problem with that is that it's really dependent on the developers to want to do it. Although it's not going to be that hard because a lot of them are also developing for PC. So I'm pretty sure they're saying, well, we're going to make this 4K game on the PC. We might as well have the graphics available for the Xbox One X.
Yeah. I think the thing that Nintendo pulled off that Microsoft didn't necessarily is that Microsoft was never in anyone's bad graces when it came to the Xbox One X.
Well, that's the other thing. You had core Microsoft fans who were not turned off. You did have Nintendo core fans who were turned off by the Wii and the Wii U.
The Wii was okay. The Wii U was such an atrocity of a generation of systems that everybody thought this was like...
The Wii, after 2 years, the core fans realized, oh, wait a minute. They're putting shareware shit on the console and we're not getting good games.
I mean, we were all ready to say this is a nail in the coffin for Nintendo. This might be the end of Nintendo. The Switch had better be the best thing to have come out ever, or else it's going to be the end of Nintendo.
And it's not to say that the Switch is flawless, because a lot of people had problems at launch. I mean, you saw all the videos of problems at launch, but at least
it came with a decent, it didn't come with, it had a decent game available. And, you know, and all the shit that was on the Wii U that they didn't like, that they didn't buy because it was on the Wii U, are being remade onto the Switch, and they're buying that. Which, by the way, will include one of my awards, the laziest sequel, which is Splatoon 2, which did exactly, it was just a port of the Wii U version of Splatoon. It would absolutely, almost nothing changed.
Yeah.
Although it did have a great bukkake thing going on with that ketchup mayo contest.
Oh, bukkake, my God.
Bukkake, bukkake, bukkake. It had to have been deliberate. You cannot convince me that they didn't know what they were doing with the friggin' mayo. I'm sorry, that was semen.
Wow.
It wasn't subtle. Especially when you have squids doing it.
Oh, boy. But, I mean, I'll stand up for it and say that I was completely wrong. Nintendo didn't put out the best system. They put out the exact system that they needed to for what their players were looking for. And Nintendo has a flourishing indie scene now. Who knew?
Well, I mean, yeah. So here's the thing. If someone like Scott tells me, do you think I should get a Switch? I would say, yes, go ahead and get it. You know, because here's the thing. You know what you're getting with a Switch. The only thing I would say is be prepared. Make sure when you buy a Switch, you get a 64-gigabyte SD card. And also, yeah, be prepared to know which games that you're going to download and erase a lot in your head, so that you can swap it out for the games that you, and the games that you really want to play. So, in fact, I would suggest getting an SD card for the games that you really know that you're going to play. Like, if Breath of the Wild, just put it on an SD card. Just save the space for the other stuff, because you know you're never gonna take it off that SD card.
Yeah.
Anyways, moving on, I know that Scott did this game as well, but I'm going to do it, and this is going to be slightly controversial, and it's the I Can Do It Better award, and I'm giving that to Super Lucky's Tale for out Super Mario Odyssey-ing Super Mario Odyssey. It actually did Super Mario Odyssey a little bit better. The only gripe that people have is that its aim is for younger children. Super Mario Odyssey, they know that adults are going to be playing it, but Super Lucky's Tale is aimed at kids, and, you know, it's somewhat easy, but then again, you know, it is so charming, it is so cute, that it makes, you know, and I keep on thinking about E3 when TJ here was denigrating it all to hell back, because there was a better Fox game.
Tunic. Tunic isn't out yet, but it's going to be the better one.
Yeah, but you know what? Here's the thing. Super Lucky's Tale is everything that Microsoft wanted it to be. I mean, it has its own little buzz with parents. And, you know, it's a safe game. It's also a very pretty
game. And Lucky's Tale doesn't look like it's going to be what Tunic is going to be. Tunic looks like kind of a Zelda game. And Lucky's Tale is a platform collecting,
yeah, it's a Super Mario Odyssey game.
Jonas said, out Marrying Mario Odyssey game.
Now, don't get me wrong. When I first saw Super Lucky's Tale, I was still pretty red hot vitriol over Yooka-Laylee, and some of that
looked too much like Yooka-Laylee, didn't it?
It did. Like, some of that spilled over, and I have no doubt that I still feel like that is exactly why I am so turned off by the idea of Super Lucky's Tale, is because I look at it and I have nightmares about writing that guide.
But here's the other thing, you know, you do have that. See, Microsoft has constantly tried to have a kids game, right? And for the most part, they haven't really done well at that. I mean, I know that Tim Schafer made that game for really young kids. That was a Kinect game, which actually did pretty well. But yeah, and here's the other thing. Microsoft doesn't have a mascot. I don't care. Master Chief is not a mascot. But he isn't. You need that happy face. Microsoft tried with Blinks. That didn't work out. And also, here's the other thing. Super Lucky's Tale is only $20.
Yeah.
Oh, and the other thing, by the way, it's also Xbox One enhanced, and it looks gorgeous. Here, it looks like actual dolls and objects on the screen. There's no, since it has simplistic but colorful graphics,
it doesn't need to have a quadrillion polygons, right? So it just looks really good when it's enhanced.
Yeah. It does look pretty adorable. Like, if I was a kid, I would look at this and I would want to play it. And I would recommend this to my brother and his nieces and his kids, and I would recommend this to my cousin and his kids. It looks like the kind of thing that you could sit down with the family and enjoy.
You know, I just realized, you know what it is, really? It's the Conquer game that they originally wanted to make. Rare originally wanted to make a Conquer game. This is it. Before they decide, oh, no, we're just going to make Conquer a alcoholic guy who curses a lot.
Yeah.
This is Conquer. We finally got Conquer 17 years later. You know, actually, let's do the RIP award for Conquer, because after Project Spark went away, goodbye Conquer. You know, we're never going to have another Conquer game.
Yeah. That might not be such a bad thing.
He has to be a foul cursing brute. TJ, give us an award.
Speaking of which, the best game nobody cared about, The Evil Within 2.
You know, that's a shame, because it's an improvement over The Evil Within 1.
Oh, in every way, in literally every way, in story and combat and stealth, they took everything that everybody hated about The Evil Within 1. And addressed it and dressed it up and made it into something well worth playing. The game came out. I heard very little fanfare about it. And it's a shame, because it really is a good game.
I watched a Let's Play of it.
First one or the second one, Scott?
Second one.
Okay.
And it confused me, because it seemed to want to be a zombie game, a serial killer psychopath is trying to get you, and a Silent Hill strange monsters coming after you kind of game.
Here's the thing, Scott.
It was all over the place for
it
me.
It wants to be Resident Evil 4. Period.
Yeah.
End of story.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And it did, and it pulled it off quite well in The Evil Within 2.
You know, I'm going to go with another most forgettable sequel. I have three of them. One was Uncharted Lost Legacy. The other was Call of Duty World War II. And I'm also going to say, compared to the hype beforehand, Assassin's Creed Origins. Here's a game that was promoted the hell out of, but it's almost, it was released. Okay. And you don't really hear much about it.
Yeah. I mean, it was one of those things where it had the misfortune of coming out right next to Super Mario Odyssey. Which, how are you going to compete with that?
Now, for my most irrelevant game, I have a completely different game. I have Marvel vs. Capcom Infinite. Because it had the bad fortune of being released at the same time as Injustice 2, and also having a roster that was microscopic compared to it, and just not being very good.
It's baby's first fighter in every way, shape, or form. It is literally press down twice and press a button and you do a combo. That's all there is to it. And that works for some people, but like, they pandered. And that is exactly what the fighting game community hates, is pandering. Accessibility is neat and all, and they're doing nobody is better equipped to probably handle accessibility like Arc System Works, and that's why everybody is super interested in Dragon Ball FighterZ.
Yeah.
Because it's accessible.
And it also looks amazing. It looks like a cartoon.
Yeah. And not only that, but like, there's still some measure of skill in it. Like, I played it at E3 and I felt like everything was easy to pull off, but when it came to playing against someone that also knew the moves, I had to work at it to win. And that's what I like. I like being challenged.
You know what? I'm going to go. Go ahead.
Marvel vs. Capcom Infinite is full of several characters that if they do a certain combo right, they can just infinitely loop that combo until the enemy is dead. And that's stupid. That is stupid. Because if you can get one combo off that means that you're going to defeat me right then and there, that's decided. I don't want to play anymore. Oh, why God, am I yeah, here?
Fighting game juggling is so hard to make fair. You have, you know, that's one of the things that I really didn't like about games like Street Fighter, is that if they started juggling you, you might as well just quit right there. It doesn't matter.
You can put down the controller because you're pretty much done already.
Yeah. So I want to go on a positive note here and talk about the best fan game, and I'm pretty sure you could guess what I'm about to say, is Sonic Mania.
My childhood lives, game of the year.
Here's the interesting thing. The only problem with it is that they made the level so expansive that the 10-minute timer actually is a factor now.
Yeah. But, you know, it's Sonic, baby. It's Sonic in every way, shape, and form. It's Sonic in the hands of people that love Sonic and not just a bunch of upset, overworked producers that are being on for that have to push a game out by Christmas.
And you know what's really funny is that Sonic Team, the people who actually make Sonic games, then farted out Sonic Forces, which is one of the worst-reviewed games of the year. It's sort of, like, embarrassing. Here's a bunch of fans who made a really good Sonic game, and oh, by the way, here's the official Sonic game. It's shit. I wonder if Sega actually saw Sonic Forces, then looked at Sonic Mania and said, oh shit, we better get buy Sonic Mania from these people, so that we don't have a shitty Sonic game to put out.
Well, I mean, there's a reason why the Sonic Mania got a collector's edition and Sonic Forces didn't.
And, oh, by the way, Sonic Mania is also on Steam.
Yes, and there's mods for it. People have been making stuff to play around with that game as far as, like, levels, new sprites. Somebody went and took that creepypasta of Sonic and put it into the game as you can play as that Sonic.
And, you know, I wonder if Sega as a publisher will start being an anti-Nintendo and start looking at what fans are doing with their license and say, you know what? We want games that people who actually love our IP make. You know, what they're making, we should look at what they're doing.
Oh, you're making a good Sonic game? You're hired.
Yeah, that sounds like what that should happen. I don't know if it does, but that does sound like what should happen.
Now, I know there are these people who are making an X-Wing versus TIE Fighter game, if I remember correctly. And EA has been sort of, okay. And if I were EA, I would say, you know what? Okay, you guys are doing a good job here. Here's the money. Finish it, and we'll publish it. You'll get a cut.
Yeah. I mean, it couldn't be any worse than what they did with Battlefront 2.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure one of you has an award for that one. Go ahead. If you have an award for it, go ahead.
I mean, the dumbest controversy of 2017 award for me goes to Battlefront 2.
Yeah, and there's another thing, you know, in which they're attacking EA because EA is EA, and, you know, I don't, you know, they made getting characters even easier because the fans whined, and they kept whining. Here's the thing, you know what, EA, sometimes you gotta ignore them. I mean, you ignore fans on the worst stuff, but you listen to them on the worst stuff. You know, I would listen to them when they complain about things like Mass Effect Andromeda, which I gave the worst soft reboot award. You know, but you pay attention to them on this? Really?
Yeah. And moreover, like, I'm not even talking about EA at this point. I'm talking about loot boxes. I'm talking about loot boxes or gambling in specific, which
Here's
is
the thing.
Wrong.
Unless there's a paywall, I don't care. I will draw the line at a paywall. Oh, you want to finish the story? Pay up.
Gamers will look in the face of what they want and walk backwards off a cliff.
Now imagine if they took all that energy about loot boxes and aimed it towards net neutrality.
Yeah. I'll tell you what.
I want games to cost $90 now just to slap them in the face and say, okay, you don't have loot boxes, but now the game's costs a lot more because they need to make the money somehow.
Yeah, learn some cheat. Yeah, here's some cheat codes like you wanted, but the game costs $90.
Which I would not care about, by the way. Because, you know what? If I want a game, I don't have to own every single game in existence. That's the other thing. Why do they... They'll complain about games they're not even going to buy. You know? My advice would be, wait for a Humble Bundle so you can get 7 games for $1.
So, yeah. I have a word I want to give. The best creepypasta award goes to Doki Doki Literature Club. This game, I swear, this is the definition of creepypasta. You go into it thinking, oh, this is just a cutesy little visual novel dating game. And it's not. Oh my God.
It looks like a dating sim, right? But here's the thing. It's not made by a Japanese team. It's made by a guy named Dan Salvato.
Yeah, and it's free on Steam. So, you know, but it's this game where you join a literature club and you're writing these poems for these girls and you try to gear it up for them to like it. And as you're going along, you're finding out about some of them have problems and issues, and then suddenly the game starts fucking with you and breaking the fourth wall and just really they allude to it. There is some foreshadowing, but if you're not really paying attention to it, it really does surprise you how it's a horror element.
Scott, did you ever play Frog Fractions?
No.
Well, here's the thing. That's another free game. Look up Frog Fractions by Twinbeard. Play it. It is the same kind of out-of-nowhere, batshit crazy title you'll ever play.
Okay.
It starts out as an edutainment game in which you're playing a frog who has to do fractions, you know, math fractions. Mm-hmm. Just play it, because here's the thing. I can't say anything about it. This is a game that I will absolutely... not spoil whatsoever. You have to discover it for yourself. Do you know this game, TJ? Frog Fractions?
Yes, I've heard of it.
Okay. If you haven't played it, play it. Because it's free, there's no reason not to. But yeah, it sounds like Frog Fractions, in which you start off, it's a poem writing minigame, and wait a minute, what? Let me ask you a question, Scott. How many times did you openly say, what? While playing it?
Yeah, quite a bit. It gets horrifying, and so, you know, this is one of those games that's going to stick with me for a while, and I feel like I need to give the creators money, at least a ticket, movie tickets worth, like $20 or something, just that's how good it resonated, and it's like, oh my gosh, this was very well done.
It's another Frog Fractions, you know, one of those free games.
Yeah.
And here's the thing, when they're not charging you anything for it, obviously it's a labor of love.
Yeah. it's a labor of love or sadism, I haven't decided which.
And by the way, Dan Salvato doesn't really like anime, so I think this was a sort of like take that at anime.
Oh yeah, definitely, yes. I definitely feel that there was some mocking towards these kind of games and towards people that play them. And I think there's a lot of, this is definitely one of those art kind of games where you could do debating about reality and games.
To be fair, all that most visual novels are fucked up.
Yeah.
But they're more straightforward fucked up.
Yeah. So I had to make that tweet to TJ earlier. The Roger Wilco art.
Like I said, Frog Fractions, Doki Doki Literature Club, they're both free. There's no reason not to see what it's all about.
Yes.
And if you like it, like Scott says, make a donation.
Mm-hmm.
So, TJ, you have another reward for us.
Let me see what I got here.
Okay, well, you know what? While you're looking, I'm going to give an easy award to give, and that's Best DLC, and I'm giving it to Injustice 2. Because while I'm not a fan of the single-player campaign, they have been knocking it out of the park with every single fighter that they've released. Every single one. Not a single one has been a dud. And I'm not even talking about, you know, the main fighters, the alternate skins have also been great too. Like Black Lightning is great. Jay Garrick is awesome. You know, Power Girl is great. Vixen, you know, all these alternate skins, just because of the fact that they have their own unique dialogue and voice actors too.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree with that. The Warner Brothers, like NetherRealm Studios, has figured out fighters to a T. They know what people are looking for, and they're the perfect little teasers when it comes to giving it away. Like, who knew that in 2017 we would get to play a fighting game in which Hellboy, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and Batman are gonna fight each other in the same game.
You know what? Here's the thing. What's really funny is that everybody thought that the Turtles were going to be Rorschach. and NetherRealm knew it, too, because they teased it. Because when you first see Raphael, he's in his trench coat, and you can't see his face. You can't really see anything. All you see is a trench coat and a hat. And everybody said, oh, it's Rorschach, of course, because that's what people were – nope, it's not Rorschach.
Nobody thought it was going to be The Question?
No. Because well, I know the Rorschach is based on The Question, but yeah, The Question isn't as big a thing. And by the way, more people. Let me ask you a question. Do you think more people think of The Question as Renee Montoya now?
I only think of The Question in the form that he was displayed in Justice League Unlimited.
Oh, okay. Because... Oh, you mean the paranoid psychotic?
Yeah. I mean,
that's a take that to Steve Ditko, who was an objectivist, and The Question was his creation.
Mm-hmm. But The Question character arcs in Justice League Unlimited were actually pretty cool.
You know what? I'm gonna go ahead again, and I have three games, which is the best RPG no one is talking about, and the first one is kind of subjective because I know these games have their fans. But they're not getting the same kind of push that you'd normally get. First one is Divinity Original Sin 2, which a lot of people say is the best RPG out there right now, but no one's talking about it. No one except fans of the series. What?
I said my friends are. We're talking about it. But I mean,
but on a wider scale, you don't really see it getting the props that it deserves.
Yeah. Which I guess is fine with me. I mean, if the company makes its money, then that's fine with me. I mean, because like there's gonna be two isometric RPGs next year, Pathfinder's Kingmaker and Pillars of Eternity 2 are coming out next year. So there's just a plethora of isometric games. I hope they do as well as Divinity 2 seems to be doing.
Well, here's the thing.
At least.
Larian is probably the best reason to for Kickstarter, you know, because Divinity was given new life by Kickstarter. All of the Divinity games,
right?
So yeah, I mean, Larian Studios found a niche, and they have their fans who will back them on Kickstarter to get their games made, which is probably the best reason for Kickstarter. You know, you have a developer. The fans love their work. The publishers aren't going to give them the money because they're very niche in the way they, you know, in the games that they make, isometric RPG. So you just get enough money to make the game for your fans. Boom. And other people who hear about it will buy it from Steam.
Yeah.
The next one is Torment Tides of Numenera. I backed it on Kickstarter. As a matter of fact, I haven't played it yet, so... This is partially my fault. I bought it and I haven't been talking about it.
Yeah, I agree with that one. That was also a good upgrade. I gave that award because it's such a beautifully done sequel to the original. And
you mean spiritual sequel? You mean spiritual successor? I mean, because it has nothing really to do with Planescape Torment.
Right, right. Nothing to do. That's true. But it does take place in Planescape. And so it does
sort of Planescape because they don't have the D&D license.
Okay,
it takes place on the outer planes, and it takes place in a sort of fantasy setting that's like
still doing D&D. Some of the same mechanics. Though they have the same classes like Jack of All Trades and
you can't really copyright those, now can you? I mean, you can't copyright fighter, cleric, mage, you know, that sort of thing.
Right, but they're still doing the same kind of basic mechanic. But, like, I guess, like you said, spiritual successor, and it's really just trippy the way you start the game and the character creation. You're in this, like, limbo, and you're answering questions and walking this
path. You know, the thing about Planescape Torment was that it had 500,000 words, if I can remember correctly. It was the novel that you played.
Yeah, that's what it feels like. It's like you're playing a novel.
And while don't like the wordiness, I mean, even Yahtzee doesn't like it. But there are players who like a little more games. Intellectual game, you know, and don't mind.
Yeah, that's the point. The point of them is to have all the words.
Yeah, like I said, you know. It's okay not to like it. It doesn't mean that you're a bad gamer. It's just that there's a segment who really want this sort of game.
Yes, and I think I feel really happy to see all these isometric RPGs that I get to play now, and there's other people that wanted to play these games, and for a long time there wasn't anything, and now suddenly we're getting so many. Yeah.
Scott is getting his isometric RPG free con.
Yep, definitely.
Now, the third one I'm going to mention is sort of surprising because it was backed by a major publisher, Ubisoft, and that would be South Park, The Fractured Butthole. And
I wanted to give that the best pun award, but could continue.
It hasn't really made the cultural impact that even the first game did, you know? There was a lot of chatter about South Park, the next South Park game, but you know what? It really hasn't I really haven't seen people talking about it all that much.
Yeah, there hasn't been much. That's true. It's almost like, yeah, that almost seems like forgettable. You have to remind yourself, well, yeah, this game's out. And it's $60, not cheap.
Well, actually, you know what? I'm continuing getting it because right now it's available for $29.99.
Ooh. On Steam or
what? No, in GameStop.
I guess Steam. Oh, okay.
But maybe on Steam too. I mean, it is the holiday season, and
it's holiday sales is 21st, so it hasn't started yet. No. But yeah, people haven't been talking about it. People like Fallout 4 and Skyrim. People are making meme jokes all over the place. This, it's like, is it out? Nobody's discussing it, or
the licensed game is part of it. It's like, oh, it's another South Park game.
Yeah.
I know TJ was going on and on about the game, about the name. He loved the pun name. He couldn't at E3. He kept on repeating it over and over again.
Fractured butthole.
We're fractured butthole.
I think. You know, one of the biggest things about South Park episodes is their timeliness and like how they hit during certain subjects.
Oh, the problem is that they also age fairly quickly. I mean, Britney Spears episode. Wow.
So yeah, one of the biggest problems that the Fractured Butthole faced is that it was a game spoofing superhero movies. About 3 years after everyone was sort of already tired of superhero movies.
Oh, I definitely am tired of superhero movies. As a matter of fact, when The Last Jedi is more like a Marvel movie than a Star Wars movie, it just Disney cut it out. We're not even going to discuss Disney buying Fox. I mean, where's the antitrust? Anyway, let me do a positive one before we move on to another one. I want to do the news that made me play an older game more. And I think I talked about this earlier in the podcast, and that's Civilization VI Rise and Fall. Now, that's a 2018 game, but all the Civ news, I've been playing Civ VI again. And, you know, it's like, I think I'm getting amped up, and the expansion isn't even coming until March, I think it is. Is it March that is the release date?
February 8th, I thought.
Whatever. It's a few months away, and it's making me want to play Civilization VI again.
Yeah, I think I'm going to wait for the expansion to come out, and then I'll play. Because I want to be, like, totally, totally different.
How about you, TJ? Are you amped for Rise and Fall?
haven't played Civ 6 in a while, just because I've had a lot of other stuff to play. It's just one of those things where I get to it when I can. It is a good, relaxing game.
You probably just play Total War Warhammer all the time, don't you?
I do like Total War Warhammer.
Well, then you must be excited about the expansion that was announced.
I'm okay with it.
Although I will say Warhammer 2 was an expansion that wasn't an expansion. It was a secret expansion.
I mean, it was an expansion in the way that, like, what is it? Lost Legacy is an expansion to Uncharted 4.
No.
it is, because, I mean, it's its own thing with its own rules. So, I mean...
Okay, TJ, give us an award now. You've had time to look them over.
I'm going to go with the lesson I didn't learn game of the year, Destiny 2.
Oh, so yeah, you were talking about how great Destiny 2 was. That changed quickly, didn't it?
Yeah, it did have a better story. It did have a better narrative. It did have a definitive ending. And then there was just like the same old Destiny stuff. And I don't care. Crucible, doing raids, repeating the same tasks over and over and over and over and over again.
People loved that in Borderlands, and I didn't, you know, and it made me feel bad because Destiny is everything that Borderlands is. Just Borderlands doesn't say it's an MMO.
No, that's not true. Borderlands had actual quests that moved the story along up until you finally get to You Will Die, and that's the point. You get to that one, you fight the giant monster that's supposed to be really tough with your pals, you do it, and then you're done with the game.
You know what?
Destiny 2 just wants to keep going over and over and over again, and it gives you the same tasks over and over and over again, just like, you know, do it a different way. Do it faster. You might get a new gun, or you might get a new helmet. And you know what?
All this reminds me is that I'm glad I heard nothing about Tales from the Borderlands, or else I never would have been shocked. Not shocked, but what's the word I'm looking for? Surprised by the air gun scene, the finger gun scene.
The big problem with Destiny 2 is that, for me anyways, it's that it's...
There's no finger guns?
It does... Well, yeah, that too. But it does what every MMORPG does. It relies on getting players to do the same crap over and over again in the sheer chance that they might get a different outcome. It's the mouse pressing the button several times until it gets the cheese.
Hello, what is Diablo again? But here's the thing about Diablo, though, and here's the thing about any game of its ilk in which you're doing that, you have to get the loot drops right. Because if you don't get the loot drops right, the reward is not going to be there. That was the thing about Diablo, especially Diablo 2. Those loot drops are pitch perfect. Ditto with World of Warcraft. Destiny, when you get a new gun, you don't really care.
But even with Diablo, it's a lengthy game that eventually ends with you fighting the Satan.
Yeah, I know. I get it. But, you know, here's the thing. I know people who played Diablo over and over and over again, right? Is the same kind of game in which you're just clicking, 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 you know? But the thing is, in Diablo, the loot drops... Well, let me put it this way. World of Warcraft, which was basically Diablo with Warcraft setting. Again, click, 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 click. I mean, the combat in World of Warcraft is dull. I mean, yeah, if like you're a healer, you might have to heal people or tank or whatever. But you know what? It was the loot drops that made the game. And that's what Destiny failed at. Destiny 1 and 2. You get a loot drop, I don't care. Do you ever care about the stuff that drops?
There was one gun in Destiny 2 that I really enjoyed. And that's... I get it. I get why people stay in there to get those cool-ass guns, because they add them in there and they turn out to be awesome. But it's not enough to build a game on for me.
Well, here's a question for you. How much do you care about multiplayer? I mean, versus multiplayer, you know?
Only so much as I'm willing to... only so much as I'm willing to try it until I'm bored and then I'm done. And that happened very quickly. I mean,
if you're not into Counter-Strike, then you're not going to be into Destiny 2.
But I am into multiplayer in certain games. I love League of I go back to League of Legends on a regular basis because it always gives me...
That's not a first-person shooter now, is it?
Yeah, but Rainbow Six Siege is. And I love that game.
But in that, there is no story, and you're just doing mission, you know, arenas, basically, over and over and over again. Destiny 2 doesn't have that. Destiny 2 is a grind in which you're grinding until you get to multiplayer, fairly generic team versus team multiplayer with no, you know... Rainbow Six Siege is crafted specifically for, what is it, 3-on-3? Is it 3-on-3 gameplay? I forgot.
Well, that, and I think I just don't think that, I think I just don't enjoy the, like, the Destiny style. I don't really enjoy, I have gone past the point where I am interested in, like, you know, Halo and Destiny multiplayer anymore. It's the constant team deathmatch.
I do like Halo multiplayer. I don't play it anymore, but when I play it, I have fun.
I get bored. After a while, I get bored.
Well, that's the good thing about Halo multiplayer, though. It's subservient to the single-player campaign. Or at least they go hand-in-hand. I mean, you're going to get people talk shit about Halo, the Halo story, and I don't understand where it's coming from. Maybe it's because I'm invested in the story and I've followed it. So I'm able to put up with, you know, good enough multiplayer. And, oh, by the way, people bitched about the microtransactions in Halo 5. And it turned out to be nothing. The rec cards you could get... If I really wanted a gold rec card, I play three big team battle matches. Whether I win or lose, I'm going to make enough money to get it. Boom. I don't have to spend any money.
Yeah. I mean, the fact of the matter is I've just never really been a MMORPG person. Because the crux of an MMORPG, like World of Warcraft or Destiny 2, is... Yeah, we got the boys together and we did this this raid. We did this quest and we beat it. But we didn't get enough to unlock the thing we wanted, or we didn't get the random number generator to give us the thing. So let's go back and do the same thing again. And
oh, Lord.
I'm not in for it.
And World of Warcraft used to not respect people's time and make 5-hour frickin' dungeons.
That didn't bother me at all. As a matter of fact, when they started making, you can go from 1 to 60 in 5 minutes, that sort of bothered me. When they compressed all the skills, that turned me right off and I didn't come back.
See, but that does bother me because I don't have that time and I don't want to make that time.
I don't have that time either.
I don't have that time either, but you know what? I was enjoying the journey more than the end thing. See, I'm not the sort of person who wants to see how fast he can get to level the max level. I'm not a speedrunner. I was the sort of person who enjoyed wandering around this big world in World of Warcraft, interacting with people, you know, occasionally joining because I was always a pickup guy. I never had a guild. You know, just enjoying the world, you know? And when I started fucking with the world, I lost interest. I mean, I didn't mind Cataclysm that much, although I did miss that huge sand dune that they turned into a forest. Or it got filled up by water, you know? And basically, we were playing World of Warcraft 2 there. But after a while, I just said, it's not doing it for me. And I never picked up the Kung Fu Panda expansion.
Mist of Pandaria.
Yeah.
I still have that mouse pad.
Oh, that's cool.
My wife used to be huge into World of Warcraft, and she had the collector's edition of Mist of Pandaria.
Okay, Scott, it's your turn. Do you have any more awards?
Sure. I had one for Best Island Adventure. It goes to Rhyme.
Hey, that's another game I could put to the... Got a lot of buzz. Hadn't heard anything about it since. As a matter of fact, I don't even know if I remember that Rhyme was released.
Yeah, it got released, and it's... I don't know why some games get buzz and some don't, but this one just seems like a nice exploration game. You get stranded on an island, and You know, maybe it's because...
I'll tell you what, it's a better The Last Guardian than The Last Guardian was.
Oh, definitely. You're exploring this island, and I think you're past this where you don't attack things, but if things come at you, you have to run away from them, and you have puzzles to solve, and it just looks like this beautiful, nice game, you know, where you're just kind of relaxed a bit, and, you know, I don't know, it just, maybe it's these action games just get more buzz.
You know, it came out in May, and it's like, I don't remember, you know, anything about it. You know, I remembered how cool it looked when it was first announced, but then it's like, yeah. It's released and, oh, it got released? Really? You know, I think we're coming to a point in which we have super saturation of the game market, in which things are announced, they have a buzz, but there's so many friggin' games out there that it's easy for them to get lost.
Yeah.
Even games that you show interest in.
There is another game that does seem to be having some buzz, and that's Animal Crossing Pocket Camp Edition. I know a lot of YouTubers have been playing that one.
Oh, well, you know what people are talking about is that Tamagotchi is coming back for cell phones, which is actually the perfect place for it.
Yeah. Don't think I'd want that, but I understand it, yeah. It'll notify you, feed me, and you, I guess, press a button and feed it.
I mean, it's a cell phone game. They're going to give you notifications when your Tamagotchi needs you. And the only reason that it might suffer is because you're deliberately being a prick. I'm deliberately torturing my Tamagotchi. Did you ever do that?
That's going to be a time waster.
They cost too much to do that with the original. You want them to live. I never owned a Tamagotchi, but I know horror stories from people who were upset that their Tamagotchi died.
Yeah, and they did funerals and buried them and stuff, and it's just silly.
Yeah.
So, I'm going to talk about sports games for briefly. The best sports game that was released was FIFA 18, and for the reason that I spoke of, I think, last week when we were talking about competition, and that is EA's FIFA 18 has to be good. Because Pro Evolution Soccer is competing with it. And my two worst games are NBA 2K18 and Madden NFL 18. One was shit, the other one was shittier, and they both really didn't have any competition. I mean, yeah, NBA Live came out, but it wasn't all that good either.
Yeah.
Now, you're a Pro Evolution guy, aren't you, DJ?
I do like Pro Evolution. I think they've gotten better with it in the last couple of years to where they're actually... on par, if not actually beginning to overtake FIFA a bit.
Well, I know that the strict gameplay was always better than FIFA's, or at least a little bit better. And that's why FIFA's gameplay had to be improved, because Pro Evolution was pushing it.
Ball control in Pro Evolution has always been, like, one of the biggest things. Like, not just that, but gravity, physics, weather conditions. Those are all things that, like, really actually make a difference in Pro Evolution and make it interesting.
And, you know, NBA 2K18 is perhaps the most disappointing, because there, people complaining about microtransactions, they had a point, because that was severely restricting gameplay. Even as far back as NBA 2K15, they had to alter the stats so that you had weird things like, well, you had to be good at one thing to be good at the other. I mean, free throws? Do you really have to be good at three-pointers to have to do a free throw? Really? And they're all lumped in the same skill, because they wanted people to spend the money on that so they can charge more. So you had to get the virtual currency. NBA 2K18 was just ridiculous, and I'm glad I stayed away from it. Meanwhile, Madden NFL 18 is just lazy. I couldn't tell you the difference. And their idea of a career mode, the long shot thing. But you know what really pisses me off the most? If you look at the Metacritic for Madden NFL 18, it's really high. 88, 89. Because I'm going to tell you the dirty little secret about game reviewers. Most of them don't give a shit about sports games, and they will just they don't care. They'll spend 2 hours and base a review on the graphics and 1 hour of gameplay, and they won't care about the rest. You know, and it really annoys me. There are so few. Even the good game reviewers, they don't have much time anymore to write a review. But the if you look at the user reviews on, say, Xbox Marketplace, it has 2.5 stars, and most of the reviews, most of the recent reviews have been 1-star reviews. And I think it's a problem. We need actual competent sports game reviewers. And, you know, I'm not the sort of person who says, these reviewers suck, you know, because everybody has opinions. But you know what? When you write a review praising stuff that if you play the game for more than 2 hours, you realize is absolute shit, there has to be, you have to do better.
Yeah. Well, let's. I've got one more award left, and it's going to take us to a positive note. The best use of Satan in a video game. Cuphead.
South Park, big, harder and uncut? Longer, harder and
uncut? Nah, Cuphead, all the way.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's the backstory.
We haven't had a good Satan in a while, and that one is jolly, angry, feisty. Evil. And
hey, you know, if you're gonna do a stupid bet, you deserve Satan.
And also, he's also a cheap son of a bitch at the end of the game. Which is perfect.
Spoil it, but you know, but here's the thing, you know.
No, I mean just like
I know when I'm you fight saying, here's the thing. The 20s and 30s animated cartoons were really dark.
Yeah.
Really, really dark. And this just reflects that. They did their research.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, like, fighting him, he uses some attacks that I would say, like, as far as the rest of the game went, it was fine, I understood, but he did some attacks that just, like, made me actually lividly angry at the game.
Yeah, well, you know, welcome to bullet hell. I'm like Ikaruga, even though I suck at it, okay?
Cuphead was dang good, and their use of the main man downstairs was pretty dang good as well.
You know what really pleases me is that if they're going to make a Cuphead 2, it's probably going to take them 3 years at the minimum because of the cel-shaded writing and all that stuff. Unless, of course, Cuphead 2 is a cheap knockoff, and for whatever reason, which I'm pretty sure it won't be. You know, and I'd love to see what they do next with that style and license, if they choose to. I mean, they may choose, oh, we did this, we're done with it, just leave it for history. But, you know, I mean, there's so many genres you can do with that style. And I hope they inspire other people to make the same style. I'm getting sort of sick and tired of the 8-bit, 16-bit retro games. I mean, they're fine. But imagine if people started wanting to make more games like Cuphead.
Yeah. I mean, like, really exploring the boundary of what you can do with the art and the visuals and the gameplay.
Because the industry, like any other industry, is a very imitative industry. If something's successful, you can bet there's going to be 6 or 7 other people doing the same sort of thing. And that's fine, so long as they do it well.
I mean, in a way, Cuphead came out of that same ilk. Like Cuphead is the studio that made Cuphead is they got their start on Newgrounds, which is where you see the crews like the Behemoth, which was Alien Hominid and Castle Crashers, like
and Battle Block Theater and
yeah and like yeah, they
you
got
want
their
to talk
start
about a hard game. Oh God, Alien Hominid.
Yeah,
that was brutal. unlike Cuphead, it was also unfair, I think. Cuphead is fair. It's tough but fair. Alien Hominid? No, it's just abusive.
Uh-huh. But those guys are artistic. Like, if you really think about it, the Behemoth games are super different from one another.
Except for the style. The style, you can always tell what a Behemoth game looks like. You can see right off the bat what style they have.
They have a certain cel-shaded style that is always.
But I think that's what I want to see out of MDHR.
You know what I'd love to see? Picture Cuphead 2 being the same sort of game that The Binding of Isaac is.
You know what I would like to see? I would like to see them riff on a theme of like Duck Dodgers in the 24th and a half century.
I thought you were talking about Duck Amuck. If you ever played Duck Amuck on the DS, in which you have to abuse Daffy using the screen, and at one point you actually have to close the screen on him.
Nah, I'm talking about, I would love to see them do like a riff off of that, that sci-fi style. Buck Rogers in the 24th century.
Oh, okay.
Just like cheesy, chintzy sci-fi.
Okay, so
it makes me think of Space Quest.
Oh, yeah. So, there's one more game I'm giving an award to, and it's the best licensed game for an awful, awful movie, and that is The Mummy Demastered. Yes, a game based on The Mummy, the Tom Cruise film, was actually good. Wrap your head around that one, folks.
It was better than the movie.
Oh, well, you know, the lint in my belly button was better than the movie. You think we're going to be seeing any more movies in the Dark Universe?
The funny thing is that they spent probably around $20 million on that movie, and they probably spent around $100,000 on that game.
But, you know, there was another game a long time ago, which actually came out before the movie, and that was X vs. Sever, the GBA game. Was a really good first-person shooter game on the Game Boy Advance note. Mm-hmm. And not only was it a capable first-person shooter, but it also had two different perspectives. You could play as X, and then you could play as Sever. And as we all know, Ballistic, X vs. Sever, is the 0% movie on Rotten Tomatoes with the most reviews. I think it has 117 reviews, all of them negative. And not even slightly below average, no. Bad negative. And yet, X vs. Sever, the GBA game, was pretty good.
Wow, you ain't kidding.
So, yeah, I mean...
The other one is X-Men Origins Wolverine, which turned out to be like one of the most kick-ass action games of its year.
But you know what? X-Men Origins Wolverine, the movie... was good if you just embrace the badness and the kitschiness of it. Like when Wolverine is slashing at the fire escape. It's sort of like a video game.
Yes.
How can you not like a game with Will.i.am acting really bad in it?
I will agree with you. The X-Men Origins Wolverine... Wait, were you talking about the movie or the game? The game was great.
I'm talking about the movie. I'm talking about how bad it was, and that's why it was so fun to watch. It was interesting. I'll tell you this. It was more watchable than the Wolverine, the one that was set in Japan. So dull. And stupid, too. I mean, it was even more stupid than Origins, actually, if you want to think about the plot.
The Merc with a mouth has no mouth.
Yeah, well, you know, that... that doesn't bother me. I mean, people bitched about the Mandarin in Iron Man 3. I didn't. I thought it was a clever plot twist.
No, man, it's like the... You know, you fucked up the Mandarin.
Shut up. I don't care. Lex Luthor was ruined. The Mandarin wasn't.
I will say this. If they didn't do what they did with Wolverine Origins... they wouldn't have been able to get away with what they did with Deadpool.
By the way, you know what? There's a group, I forgot their name, not Bat in the Sun, they do the superpower beatdown. But there's another group that did a Deadpool versus Deadpool video in which Deadpool from Deadpool faces off against Deadpool from X-Men Origins Wolverine. And it's hilarious as fuck. Just do that search, Deadpool versus Deadpool, and you'll probably find it on YouTube.
All right.
Anyways, this podcast is approaching 3 hours, which is fine because we're not going to have a podcast next week. So it's like we might as well have a huge podcast. We should talk about
So, Scott, anything else, or are you done?
I think that was it, really. Everything that I wanted to mention got mentioned, so I'm happy.
So, you know what, let's finish this off with the game that we're most looking forward to in 2018. Scott?
That's a tough one, but I'll go with Pillars 2.
Which one? I didn't hear you.
Pillars of Eternity 2.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's the one I want to go with.
How about you?
Go
ahead.
I'm looking forward to sailing the seas, discovering islands, having a small party, but also being able to manage a ship and its crew and just looking for a giant statue walking through the ocean. So I'm really looking forward to it.
I bet you're probably also looking forward to Dragon Quest XI. But the problem with that is that one, it doesn't really have a release date in 2018. They just think it's going to be released in 2018.
Yeah, sometime 2018. But I mean, yeah, and I think I'll be getting that on PlayStation probably the PlayStation. But we'll see. If I get a Switch, then maybe on the Switch.
How about you, TJ?
Off the top of my head, probably Dragon Ball FighterZ right now. It's got the most going for it as far as I'm huge into fighters, and that's going to be my go-to when it comes to 2018.
I'm going to go with Red Dead Redemption 2, only because I'm really curious to see what that's about. But for the games that I know are coming out that are not the big games, I think I'm going to go with Call of Cthulhu. Because we saw that at E3. It looked fantastic. And I know you're about to say, oh, wait, that's right, Vampyr. We have to talk about that game, too, coming out in 2018. And while I know you like Vampyr because it's Mass Effect with vampires, I'm going to go with Call of Cthulhu because it looks like an actual detective game. You know? One that you actually have to think.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that struck me so interesting about Vampyr is that it's... I mean, it's more like Witcher to me, first off, but it's also like just like the adherence to vampiric lore that it has, and it's really funny, just like the way that they situate certain things. Like, they go by the rule that if you're like old vampires cannot enter someone's home unless they were invited in. So you have to like do all this trickery to get people to trust you and invite you. Yeah.
So, go ahead.
That said, I am extremely interested in Call of Cthulhu because we haven't had a game that just like is so dead set on full on investigation over the ideas of action or fighting or.
Well, that's the thing about Call of Cthulhu. By the way, if you play the role playing game, there isn't any fighting in that pen and paper role playing game because if you end up fighting, you die. Period. That's in. Game over. The thing that you're really most concerned with, and I'm hoping that they include this aspect, is the sanity. Because in Call of Cthulhu, you're going to go insane. You just don't know when. And I'm wondering how much of a sanity meter the game is going to have. Because they didn't really discuss that to any degree.
Well, one of the coolest things that we saw about Call of Cthulhu, it was something they hinted at, but they didn't really expand because it sort of seemed like they were still working on this concept, is that as you go through the game... Not only do you build a narrative like of trust, you build a reputation, but you also build phobias.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, there's your sanity meter.
If you deal with certain situations too much, like fire, you develop a fear of fire. If you're in closed spaces and you get scared too much, you start to develop a fear of being in closed spaces. So if you are running from a monster and you try to hide in a closet, your heart starts to beat horribly fast, and it alerts the monster to your presence.
Yeah. Now, the other game that I'm sort of interested in that everybody knows is Monster Hunter World, because I've not played that game. I just know it by reputation. And it's coming to the Xbox One, and, you know, I'm sort of like thinking, you know, I might want to investigate to see what it's all about. Yeah, I know it's all about preparation for hunting. And that's sort of appealing.
Yeah. I'm interested in getting on the ground floor of that, just because I've never played them. I've never really sat down and played them.
Here's the thing, we all hear about it, you know, because people gab and gab and gab about the game, you know?
I've never heard of this, and it sounds like it's a good co-op game, too.
Well, that's the entire point, yeah. In this game, you're going to be teaming up with other people. Oh, by the way, here's a game that we forgot was coming out in 2018, and that's Tropico 6. And, you know, it's going to be interesting to see that game, because it's always a game that is sort of, like, fun, but, you know, it just has that air to it. All the Tropico mm-hmm. games do. And silence.
Yeah,
I have no interest in that game. Sorry.
Really? Well, we're going to see Terry Crews in Crackdown 3. Maybe Scott, TJ likes that.
Crackdown 3 is probably going to be fun, but I don't know if I'm going to be able to play it until they... I know.
Okay, here's the thing. Scott, TJ, you forgot to give this award. Best E3 trailer goes to Crackdown 3.
That was easily the best trailer. I mean, you can't match that energy. Nobody can.
I don't know. I was interested in We Happy Few a couple of months ago, but now I'm just like, eh.
Yeah. It still has interesting aspects, but I don't know if it, I mean, what are they even doing with that game?
It's going to be released in May. It has a release date.
I thought it had already been released.
No.
Yeah, I thought so too.
Nope. It's being released for Windows, PS4, and Xbox One on April 13th.
Yep.
One more game. And, you know, I was just thinking about it a second ago. It's coming out in 2018 that I'm really... Oh, yeah. I almost forgot. And this is a game that I'm actually really, really looking forward to, and we keep on forgetting about it. And that's Psychonauts 2.
Yeah, that's going to be a good one.
And that's yes. Game,
especially since I paid $840 for it.
Wow, yeah.
Hey, I wanted those fig, what's it called, extra, what's it called, rewards, okay? I want the book bag with the patches on it. I want all the other tchotchkes that are coming with it. I want the art book. I want everything, because I'm a huge Psychonauts. I pre-ordered the friggin' first Psychonauts, damn it. How many people can say they pre-ordered the first Psychonauts for the Xbox? I think I was one of three people who did it.
Yeah, I don't know.
I did not play Psychonauts VR, though. That was you, TJ.
Yeah, and I enjoyed that one a lot. It was a good puzzle game.
By the way, just a little question. Are you excited for the 30th anniversary of Street Fighter?
It's one of the only times they've put, like, that
Street
many
Fighter
games.
1.
Yeah. Street Fighter 1, all of Street Fighter 3, which are the best ones, by the way. Street Fighter Alpha. And
for them, too.
Yeah, some of the games. Which are really, like, they're putting online play in Street Fighter 3, Third Strike, a couple of the Street Fighter 2s, and I think Street Fighter Alpha 3, which is great. I think it's, for anyone that's never played those games, I think it's an awesome anthology.
Also, to see how simple the first one was. Basically, mm-hmm. Ken and Ryu.
And how horrible the voice acting was in it.
Well, all you have to do is play House of the Dead, the original one, to see how horrible voice acting was in those days.
This was even worse than that. Like, nice try, Kido.
Anyways, so listen, we won't see you next week because, you know, Christmas vacation, but we will see you on January 1st, the new year, and we're going to have to figure out a way to really celebrate that. Also, you know, the podcast is coming up on the big 500, which not many podcasts make it to.
That's true.
Yeah.
We'll have to have some guest stars.
Oh, I'm probably sure we will. I'm going to see if Dan can at least appear instead of just...
Maybe get Dan or Paul. That'd be cool.
I'm going to ask Jordan. I'm pretty sure Paul will do it.
No showing off feet this time.
No, that was Jordan. Yeah. I had to avert my eyes. I did not want to look at stigmata of the foot. Anyways, we're coming up on the 3-hour mark, and we hope you enjoyed this extra, extra, extra long podcast. And we really want to hear what your game, what games you're looking forward to in 2018. Just do a search for video games in 2018 and just let us know what you're really looking forward to. Are you looking forward to Kingdom Knights 3? Are you looking forward to Red Dead Redemption 2 or Sunless Skies? You know, that sort of stuff. And, you know, I didn't pick up Hollow Knight. Maybe I will sometime over the vacation.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was so enthusiastic about Hollow Knight. Now he's like, yeah, whatever.
We've got 3 hours at this point, man. I'm tired.
Well, look for our show notes.
Sleep.
Well, look for our show notes at gamingpodcast.net along with industry news and our gaming history articles. We enjoy your feedback. So leave us comments at our blog at gamingpodcast.net. Also, hit us up at facebook.com/gamingpodcast. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Leave some iTunes comments. I am on Twitter as at Jonah Falcon.
I am at Johnny Chugs.
I am at Alpha Shard.
And we will see you in 2 weeks.
Happy gaming, everyone.
Play games, have fun, and be cool, y'all.
Just hear how tired you are and the way you both said that.
Good night, TJ.
It was
good night,
like,
Jonah.
It was sort of really depressed and dark and down.
Oh, come on.
You're just so sleepy. It's cute.
Good night, buddy.
It's 9 o'clock for me. Bye-bye.
East Coaster. Or no, West Coaster now.
Yep. Bye-bye.